Spencer.
Hey.
Allison visited Rhaenyra. Dragon Riders are off to a rocky start. There's trouble brewing in the Riverlands. Daemon fights for Daenerys. Aegon has escaped. Rhaena met Sheepstealer. And boy, have we set the table for season 3. This is Mangum Talks TV, and we are here to review the finale of House of the Dragon season 2. Spencer, we've had some time to marinate because you were getting your Teddy Roosevelt on. You were exploring the wilds of America on a boat. You're back. How do you now feel about season 2 of House of the Dragon, specifically the finale?
For the finale, the queen that never was, the queen who ever was, say it correctly, I'm more negative than I was during the short form refresh.
Oh, no.
I still thought it was a solid enough episode. It had some great scenes I'm eager to talk about. I still thought the writing and the character work was good. But the fact that it was a weak finale, and the fact that I've had extra time to stew over why I felt that it was weak, has laid bare a few of the problems I saw with both this episode and the overall season. It is frustrating. I mean, the episode is ultimately, and really the season as a whole, you've loved to offer that you gotta let him cook.
Gotta let him cook.
This entire season just kind of feels like build up for season 3. It feels like it's a promise of things that will come rather than necessarily being much by itself. It's an answer delayed about whether the time we've invested is worth it or not. In my mind, it confirms, I feel vindicated in this, that 8 episodes was nowhere near god enough for them to wrap up the plot they needed to this season, or for any show, really. Please, 8 episodes is a horrible idea. Stop doing it. It also confirms in my mind that cliffhangers, which is, I feel like this finale really proudly is, work well in shows that do primarily episodic narratives, or with a certain generosity of spirit, shows that are annually renewed or annually occur. This is neither. This is a show where we may get it in 2 years' time, year and a half at best, I'm betting 2 years or longer, and it certainly isn't episodic storytelling. So it makes this idea of just this very proudly, aggressively cliffhanger kind of conclusion just a frustrating wait and stew. And It just reveals a series of just beyond just simply structural resolution issues. Even acknowledging there were scenes I definitely liked, there are just plain problems with this episode and its narrative. The Essos plot is not good. We'll talk about it. The Rhaena plot is an example of they've had an idea of how to get from A to C, and the B in the middle that we actually get to see just kind of sucks. Ending Daemon's story with the prophecy I find ultimately unsatisfying in a way that I otherwise liked what they did with Daemon's story, and if it went on too long, partly because I just don't particularly like how much they want to make the prophecy work to tie in between shows. And as I'm sure we'll hear from you in detail, the Rhaenyra-Alicent plot highlights to me that what the showrunners think is important in this story is not what I think is important, and that's getting to be more of a problem. It still was a well-written scene between quality actors. It still hit the notes they needed to and can set up some great stuff to come in terms of Allison's decision and how it plays out and what the response from Rhaenyra ultimately is as events occur. All that can be great. But the idea that the entire show is in some ways grounded in their mutual relationship is, for me at least, a fundamentally different opinion about the story and the narrative that I think sets up more problems than it offers advantages. So, did I like the episode? I thought it was fine. I think I would rank it in the bottom ones of the season, of otherwise what was a pretty good season of episodes. But it has the very bit of misfortune of me liking the season, liking what they've done, getting some proper House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones kind of feelings from the show in terms of great writing, great character work, excellent moments of both building, of plot building and world building occurring. Moments of raw excitement mixed in, but the season ultimately, was it fulfilling? Did it offer a complete story? Does it leave me excited of what's coming next? No, not really. And that's both avoidable and a damn shame.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I was more negative during the reaction podcast than you were. And now it seems like you've gotten there. I am kind of on the upswing with it, which is, and I always knew I was, and I knew after I watched it,
This is what we do.
Well, I knew that I would be because I knew that my disappointment in the episode was primarily there are some concerns with the episode. There are things, a couple of the things you pointed out, specifically Allison visiting Rhaenyra in the Essos plotline aren't great, but there's still a lot of really good stuff, but that isn't great. But my primary concern with the episode was that it was a finale and that they didn't pay off anything in season two. But the farther you get away from it being a one-time viewing experience, the less that becomes a concern. I think I care 92% as much about that as I did when the episode aired. And in 5 years, I'll care 5% as much as I did when the episode aired. Like, the farther you get away from it, the less you will get concerned about something like, oh, well, this was supposed to be a finale and it didn't pay off the plot lines I wanted it to pay off. As long as they get paid off in season three and season four or five, whatever, in a way that you like it, in a way that you will like. So I'm with you. Wasn't a particularly good finale. If you look at it through the finale lens, there's a couple of things that are concerning about the way they're telling the story, but I am more positive about the episode than I was. The only thing I strongly disagree with you about is that, not excited about season three. Like, I think I am excited about season three still. They've set up a number of plot lines that are interesting, that will come to a head. They've shown that they can do big battle sequences. The Rook's Rest was really fun this episode or this season. Mm-hmm. And, I want to see what they'll do when they have a plot that's even bigger in scope, because they do a great job with the dragons. The battle sequences have been good so far. So I'm excited about season three. It doesn't take away from the fact that there were issues about this as a finale and issues about the overall storytelling. So I think what we should do is maybe jump into our concluding thoughts about season two first and then run through a recap. What I don't want to do is do an exhaustive recap and then you and I get to our thoughts about season two and be like ready to be done with the podcast and be like tired and do like 5 minutes on it. I'd rather, if we're going to rush anything in what should be a pretty long podcast, I'd rather rush the recap because people have already seen the episode. The recap does help us break down very interesting parts of the show and spurs our conversation. But if we're going to do anything quickly, I'd rather do the recap quickly than our general thoughts on season two. So overall, I'll say something quick and throw it to you. Overall, okay. I think that season two was about on par with season one for me. Season one had issues with the storytelling and the time jumping. Some of the dialogue was a little strange in season one, but overall the world was immersive. They were setting a table for future seasons and they did that well. The casting, the acting was all really good. Where they shot, you know, the scenery. It was all great in season one. A lot of that you can just transpose to season two. They're setting the table for future seasons. The acting was great. Some of the dialogue was weird. Some of the storytelling choices was weird. But ultimately, it's like, you know, when Miguel Sapochnik, who was supposed to be sort of a co-captain on this effort when House of the Dragon got announced, left between season one and season two, I thought, oh, this is probably going to feel like a different show, right? Because if tomorrow I replaced you on Mangum Talks TV with our friend BJ, and all of future Mangum Talks TV podcasts were me and BJ, it would be a fundamentally different podcast, right? Sure. So when you take one of the leaders out of the organization, I felt like it'd be a fundamentally different show. I did not feel like it was a fundamentally different show. It still felt like writers who get a little too cute. It still felt like a lot of anticipatory stuff. It still felt like fantastic acted show and a lot of nuggets I really enjoyed. So it felt a lot like season one to me. What'd you think?
I've come more around to be with you there of where I feel like it's about the same quality, about the same enjoyability as season one, but I think it's differently flawed. I think there's reasons for why I would say that.
Okay.
Of where season one, I think, like, is structurally flawed as a season. And that was some of its problems with the pacing, with a poor concept of where to introduce characters and how to move them along necessarily, that led to overarching structural problems with the season itself. This season, I don't feel like it had those. It had some issues with – it had more issues with the – it's almost like season one rushed too much and season two didn't move enough in terms of where they went with their overall narrative.
Yeah,
I feel like season two has fewer flaws, but overall is less satisfying because at least season one told its own story, whereas season two felt like it was more setting up stories that it wants to tell in the future and had few plots that ultimately concluded and a lot of plots that didn't move as much as they should have.
I think that's fair. I think when I'm saying the storytelling, I need to change that word. Pacing. The pacing is the concern for how that They do some really great scenes. They do some really great individual episodes. I like how thematically they build their episodes. So there's a lot to like in the writer's room for sure. But the pacing is still a big problem with this show. They sped up. They slowed down. Maybe it's porridge too hot, porridge too cold, porridge just right, right in the middle for season three, Spencer. That's how we like to look at it here. They're going to get the pacing just right in season three. We have heard there's going to be four seasons of this show. I don't know how many episodes that translates to, but we'll get four seasons. You mentioned the timeline for a season three. I think a general consensus is it'd be about 2 years. You tend to skew very negative on the length of time between seasons, so you'll expect 4 years.
Eight,
if we get
12.
It in two, you'll be pleasantly surprised. I think about 2 years is what we can expect, but I do think that when we're watching the show in 5, 6, 7 years from now and it's all wrapped up and we're just binging it on a weekend, the finale of season two and how that bleeds into season three will be less of a concern, obviously. My worry is that they're just going to lose an awful lot of the audience because they were already significantly down in viewership from season one to season two. Then you disappoint folks in a widely panned season two, because I think on this podcast, we're being a lot more positive about season two. Even your take right now is more positive about season two than what the internet writ large has done. It has been mostly panned, and it's got the Game of Thrones community in this very unfortunate position, this like unenviable position of the creators that are well known in the community, certainly better known than you and I, have gone on the offensive against fans for the reaction. Like you see folks who have well-established Westeros channels who follow the show very closely on social media attacking fans for not getting it or wanting big battles every episode and therefore being kind of like dumb fans, right? Like, well, you want big battles every episode. You shouldn't be watching. You're going to hate Dunkin' Egg. You're going to think that's terrible. Like, you're not going to – don't bother reading the books because you're not going to like it. Like, you're getting a lot of that. And, like, anytime – the defenders of the show have to get antagonistic against the general fan base at large, you are in a bad spot as a show. What? So I don't feel good about where the show is, but my personal enjoyment of it is about where it was at season one, and I am excited for season three.
I feel like some of the problems that are occurring there are with marketing, setting expectations that aren't met, and HBO in some ways handicapping the show. Do we want to go into right now some information that's come out to a certain degree about...
For sure.
A lot of information has come out about why the season ended the way it did. The original comments were from the writers saying that it was the decision by Ryan Condal that, you know, he came to them and said, you know, maybe we should end on a building moment for season three. And they thought that was so brave. And they thought that was so creative. That didn't work in terms of the fan response. And now there's increasing things that I'm leaking and saying, no, they planned a 10-episode season, which you've commented from the beginning. They'd originally written 10 episodes and then George edited them down. Suddenly they had 8. But now that's also coming out in addition to that, that they had planned this to be 10 episodes, and HBO told them, no, we want to make it 8. And then between that and dealing with the writer's strike, limiting their ability to rewrite, we got this kind of conclusion to a show that was more originally planned to have the expected and originally promised the war has begun kind of conclusions to the season that we didn't ultimately get. That's a lot of what's been leaking. Does this read true to you in terms of explaining some aspects of the season, otherwise feel a bit incongruous?
So I was worried for the season when HBO went to Time Warner. You've got this like Time Warner conglomerate that now owns like half of everything under the sun in the entertainment industry, which includes like TNN or TNT, TBS, the whole Turner thing, CNN, all of that includes HBO, includes all the traditional old school Warner Brother Time stuff. It's a very, very large organization, but it's also known for being
cheap and short-sighted.
Cheap, yeah, and very much thinking about the immediate short-term profit for shareholders. So an example of this is Turner has had the NBA for forever. On Thursday nights, you can watch Kenny, Charles, Shaq. They review, you know, they watch an NBA game. They review it afterwards. It's an iconic show inside the NBA. We've all heard of the funny Charles Barkley stuff he's done on the air for TNT, right? Well, the NBA rights deal came up this year, and Amazon bid a big number for it. And the organization that owns TNT, TBS, shrugged their feet on trying to match. When they did match, it was sort of the cheapest possible match they could pull together, and the NBA flat out rejected it, went with Amazon. So now this gym in the NBA community, which has been Kenny, Shaq, Charles, Ernie for 20 years, is going to be gone after this next year, right? Because this big organization is just not going to shell out the money for original content anymore. And HBO is owned by the same organization. So I was very worried about that. It plays into the narrative I have about that organization, that they would have forced cost-cutting measures on this show that would force it from 8 episodes to 10 episodes, especially when episode 9 and 10 would have been expensive. We see where the story is. The next two episodes of the show are going to be expensive. So it's not a surprise to me that they would have cut that back. That works for me. If you look at just HBO properties and the amount of new content coming out of HBO, it's way, way, way down. If you want to support, if you want, you want to think about this, right? Think of the Game of Thrones shows that they have greenlit, right? So after House of the Dragon,
two-ish,
they've done basically two, one and a half, right? The half is an animated series, right? Mm-hmm. That it looks like we're going to get about the Sea Snake's voyages. The other is Duncan Egg, which will have no dragons. You'll have no dragons and no battles. It will
Duncan
be
Egg is a low-cost show, comparatively.
It'll be a stage play, right? What did they reject? Well, they rejected the idea for a post-Game of Thrones show following Jon Snow, which would have to be shot exclusively in cold areas. Right, which have big – I think they were planning some big battles for that. They've rejected Robert's Rebellion. They've rejected Aegon's Conquest, a bunch of stories that would be more expensive. So everything we see around this company, it plays into our understanding of how they're going to manage this property, which is we will slim it down, cut it as close as we possibly can, and reduce the overall content. So whereas when Westerosverse first got going, when Game of Thrones first premiered, everybody was so happy it was on HBO, right? Because HBO has this history of quality programming. They give the money to the shows to allow them to bloom and to tell the story that they want to tell. Look at something like The Sopranos or, it's a lot of the, even Rome ended up getting canceled, but man, did they give that show a lot of money to tell a story in the first couple seasons. They've done this over and over again. The traditional HBO, the old company before it was merged into this Warner apparatus. And so now I think we're at a point where it's flipped on its head, where we're sort of disappointed that Westerosverse has landed with HBO. Because if Westerosverse was with Amazon now, we would have Aegon's Conquest.
Too much
fun. We'd have a two or three movie miniseries about Robert's Rebellion. We'd have some of the stuff that we want to see, and we probably would have had at least bigger, maybe not 10 episode seasons, because they don't do those over on Amazon.
You'd probably
get 6 episode seasons that were maybe a little closer together, but nonetheless, you would have had the budget that they wanted. This doesn't feel like a cut because they said we like 8 episode seasons better than 10 episode seasons. It feels like a cut because they didn't want to spend the money for 9 and 10, which were going to be expensive.
Yeah. It's a damn shame because episode 8 as a setup episode to 9 and 10, it works. Its problems could be brushed aside or ignored because its purpose is then to build to what is going to be two very action-focused, climactic episodes. They're wrapping up a lot of aspects of the plot that they've been going towards the whole season. It works narratively there in a way that it doesn't as a closure of this season. And I'm with you that this doesn't feel necessarily like, because HBO hasn't been a network yet that has been, Warner Brothers and Time Warner directing it at least, that they want to do the 6-8 episode thing that everybody else is doing. Seems like they've been willing to do 10 episode shows. This more feels like, hey, those cost this much money, we'd rather move that to this year's annual budget, just so we look better in terms of our shareholder marketing numbers. I think I worry that they're going to continually chop that down even more in terms of, we're going to do a 6-episode season because that's cheaper and this market's this way, and your viewership numbers don't justify anything more than that. I think they're going to look at the viewership numbers this season and think that, well, this justifies spending less on this show and keep doing that going forward. And that is a problem in terms of being able to tell this show in any kind of complete and satisfying way.
So I kept calling it Time Warner. It's that's showing my age. It's Warner Brothers Discovery now. Every time they go through one of these mergers, there's a different name. 2022, it picked up Discovery. So that's why it became Warner Brothers Discovery. But that's the overall big, massive, think like Succession, like the big, the big conglomerate in Succession that everybody was fighting over, right? It's sort of the same idea. It owns a million different things. But one of those is HBO. And I feel like we're going to get a good season 3. I feel like we'll get a good season 4. I feel like this show will conclude. It'll be a great show. But I don't, if you're holding out hope that this will be like what Marvel did with telling stories, with the Westeros verse, you're not going to get that with this company. They could sell the property. They could drop the property. You may get it later, but they're going to, we'll get animated series. We'll get cheaper series. This may be the last big, oh, there's going to be huge dragon battles and there's going to be, you know, multi-million dollar, action sequences per episode. This may be the last one of those that we get out of Warner Brothers Discovery, which is a bummer, but you know, it's been fun.
It means I have a lot of a hope or anticipation or desire that, Duncan Egg does well. Cause that's the kind of show that they're looking to make. Relatively cheap budget, relatively simple kind of direction, less special effects they got to throw at it. A show that fits within their line items that they want to. If that show does well and resonates with an audience, they'll make more of those. I don't see them making many more House of the Dragons in the future, just because that kind of money to throw into something does not seem to be something that they want to invest. They want to be much more streamlined for their storytelling than previously HBO was willing to risk. HBO was willing to risk things. They didn't always have the money, but they were willing to take chances with some of the stories that they were willing to tell and directions they were going at that Warner Brothers seems fundamentally unwilling to do by comparison.
So I'm glad we really dived into that, because that contextualizes my thoughts about the season. I don't dislike the season. The season for me was a B-. I was maybe a B-minus season. But I'm also not that upset at the people who make the show, because I do lay a lot of this at Warner Brothers Discovery, just because I've seen that company operate with a number of properties that I really enjoy in a way that's bizarre. And I'll tell you another last piece I'll say on Warner Brothers Discovery. It's something to watch, Spencer. So put this on your Google alerts. Make sure you're watching. Last week I was in Orlando, lovely Orlando, about 3 hours from where you are.
Mm-hmm.
I love Orlando, city of joy. People go to Orlando to experience joy. And I went to Harry Potter World, the magical world of Harry Potter. Well, they do charge money to get in. I can't imagine.
I would never pay
to go into such a thing. It was a lot of fun, but and it is a big moneymaker for Universal.
I'm sure.
It was the most popular part of that park was going to the Hogsmeade and Diagon Alley for Harry Potter. And a lot of that setup is not just about the movies, but about the individual actors who were in those movies. Well, guess what, Spencer? Hmm. The first movie in the Harry Potter movies came out 23 years ago. That's getting dated in a way that if you've got a 5 or 6 year old and you want to get them watching Harry Potter, it's a harder sell to tell them to watch something 23 years old at that, you know, and build up from there as they grow. So they're redoing Harry Potter. They're going to tell the same story.
So I've heard.
But they're going to do it in a TV series, and it's going to be on HBO because Warner Brothers Discovery owns the property, and that's going to start in 2026. To do what they're saying they're going to do, which is we're going to tell this story longer than the movies did. We're going to include more from the books. We're going to reinvent it, reboot it for a modern audience. Why, Spencer? So that they can keep selling the Harry Potter t-shirts and the butter beer at the parks, and they can continue to sell the tickets to get into Universal, et cetera. If they're going to do all of that, they got to do it right. And this company has not shown a willingness to do a story like that right. So that's going to be a super interesting thing to watch you have this, the biggest moneymaker they have in their entertainment division, the Harry Potter property. Are you willing to invest the kind of money for the next 20 or 30 years to make sure that that park, that franchise, that merch, all of that IP continues to be as successful as it has been? I'm skeptical that they will. So that'll be a real decision point for that company.
That will be very curious to see. I'm with you. That is their flagship property. That is the one they see truly as their moneymaker, the one that they should be willing to invest the most in. If they are not willing to do that, that is telling going forward that they cannot be counted on as a company to actually put in the resources that are necessary to do the stories right that they're claiming are the basis of their brand.
Yeah. Okay. So let's, you and I, talk a little bit about this episode specifically. So let's give some general thoughts about this episode specifically. You talked about some of the stuff you didn't like. You said you had some pages of notes on that. Do you want to touch any more on what you liked, didn't like as we go into the recap?
Main four things I didn't like, and we can go into the recap of things I really did like. Of where, can we agree the Esso's plot? Freudian slip there. Esso's plot felt in my mind like a low budget tropey camp addition to the story that seemed more of a distraction than having any value on its own. It felt tonally inconsistent. It bordered on comedy. It was, I guess, fine enough on its own terms, but not particularly good. But it mostly just, I felt like when I was watching it, I was checking my watch to really think, this is pulling us away from things that are more interesting and more important to the overall story, and I don't get why, other than they saw what script they had for this episode and felt like they had to throw some things on it to fill the runtime. Is that okay. How you've kind of felt about it, or did it work any better for you?
I think that, that works for me. I'm looking up here, just to make sure I say it right. So Harry Potter is owned by NBC Universal. NBC Universal is working with, Warner Brothers Discovery to put that on HBO. And there's been an awful lot of talk over the past about year, 2 years that those two companies will end up merging. So I think the fate of Harry Potter and the Harry Potter series is closely tied with Warner Brothers Discovery and how they produce content and market content via HBO and Max. But ultimately, the property is owned by NBC Universal right now. Just want to make that clarification.
Good distinction. Good distinction.
So some of the stuff that I liked, since we've been kind of negative on it.
We'll do positive things for a bit.
I like everything about the dragons. I thought Sheep Stealer was fantastic. I don't dislike the Reyna plotline as much as a lot of people do. I like the dragon riders and how that's all played out. That's a plotline they've actually taken care with and has been interesting. And I like the Riverlands plot as slow as it's gone, because we're getting to a very interesting place. The most exciting part of this episode was when the Lannisters were marching, you got Reigns of Castamere, when the Starks were marching down the Twins, you got the Stark theme. When all these armies that we know that have all this weight and emotion for us are coming together and building, that's where when people say they're not excited about season three, I'm like, I don't know if that's, and I'm not talking about you specifically, I'm talking about some of the snap reactions on online that I saw. It's like, I don't know if a lot of that is just emotions talking or not, because there are some exciting things coming in season three if you like Westeros. So we'll see how that goes. So that's something that I liked. And then I'll also end with, I did kind of like the prophecy. I was a little unsure when they introduced it in season one, episode one, how it would roll, but the where they put this in, which was an explanatory mechanism for Daemon sort of growing up, made perfect sense to me. And I love the connection of the only way that he can truly inherit his brother's legacy is by basically shedding his own desire for one, is shedding the idea that Daemon is the hero of this story and that he was going to leave a personal legacy. The way he inherits Viserys' legacy is recognizing that that isn't reality, and that he's a piece of the story, and that's how he truly becomes his sort of brother's keeper, right? I enjoyed that a lot.
I loved the scenes of two characters interacting with each other, two characters confronting each other. I loved the scene of Gawain and Cole. I thought that was a great scene. I loved the scene of Corlys and his bastard son. I thought that was a wonderfully well-done scene. I liked the scene with Jace and Baela talking out in terms of how Jace was dealing with his trauma and the role that he's supposed to play. That was wonderful writing and wonderful moments between characters. I like how Daemon's plot ended, and I thought it worked for the overall season, even if I think they spent too long and too little tidbits of touching it over the course of the season. I feel like a lot of it would have worked better if they had a couple concentrated episodes focusing on it rather than a minute or two every episode going back to it. That felt like it made it feel longer than it necessarily was, and because they were having it occur over the course of an entire season. I'm going to disagree with you on this, and I'm excited to fight with you on it, about inserting the prophecy into Damon's storyline. I feel like I've never particularly liked the prophecy. I feel like it's more of a, to go meta for a second, I feel like it's more designed to connect people between shows rather than necessarily has as much value or contribution to this show. I feel like in many ways it distracts from what I feel like should be the central themes and narrative of this property and this show. And in terms of Damon's storytelling, I felt to a certain degree like it cheapened it. Because they got Damon there. They earned it. Through build-up of various episodes, through seeing his emotional reaction to the visions he was having, we got Damon around where he needed to be in terms of what he was accepting about his own flaws and his own prior motivations, his own distractions, his own obsession with himself interfering with the accomplishment of actually what it wanted to see that in terms of what actually mattered to him in terms of his relationship with other characters. We were there. By now inserting the prophecy in it, I feel like it takes away from that a bit because it removes his agency and his choice because now he's seen the future. Now he's seen what he has to do. Now he's seen, like, you know, what his role is. Rather than convincing him, you've now pushed it upon him, which I feel like that is taking away a bit what otherwise felt like well built up and earned over the course of the season. To what degree that's driven by I just don't particularly like the prophecy in terms of how they put it in the narrative, I'm not really sure yet myself. We can talk that out. But it felt like, as much as I liked where they built up and where he ended, that last little bit at the end didn't work as well for me for what otherwise felt so carefully crafted.
So I think there's probably a difference in understanding of what this story is, because I view the prophecy and the basically the ultimate war, the building to the war, the winter is coming, the building yes. to the war with the Night King coming down.
War of the Dawn and Twilight, yes.
Is Anakin as the Chosen One of the Skywalker series. It's the through line. This is more of episode 1, 2, 3 in Star Wars 2, Game of Thrones is 4, 5, 6 than it is a completely separate story. And that's different than how maybe we thought about it when we were just looking at the book canon. So I grant that book shows, our book fans will probably go, I don't like that. That's not what I thought this was. But I think that's what they're telling us.
That's what they want to struggle with, yes.
Right, in the show canon, which Martin has established, you got to think of those two things separately.
Yes.
It's spoken from word of Gurm. He said it himself.
Word of God, coming down.
Is that the War of the Dawn is that through line. It's Anakin as Chosen One to bring balance to the Force. It's Targaryens as defenders of humanity working with the Starks to defeat the others and save humanity. That is the through line of this story. And I suspect that if we ever do get another big epic in this world, it would probably be Robert's Rebellion, maybe. It looks like they're not going to do anything after Game of Thrones, so it looks like that's off the table. But I imagine anything they do in this timeline, other than the sort of the stories like Duncan Egg that are like one-off stories about people, will have that same through line in the same way that anything in that main Star Wars universe tends to tie eventually back to Anakin has chosen one, balance of the Force, the war against the Jedi and the Sith, etc. So that's how I view it. But if you don't view it that way after reading the books and you're frustrated and disappointed in that, I totally get it. But I think that's what they're going for.
I agree. It's what they are going for on the show. It is a through line. It is an epic narrative. It is a journey that has a destination and it has prophecies that are going into that. And if they do Robert's Rebellion, it will be steeped in tragedy to see that prophecy kind of defeated and cast aside and forgotten despite its overall importance. That's how they would get that in.
That actually got me a little excited right there. The downfall of the Targaryens and everybody thinking they've lost the people in the know think they've lost the war because they lost this war.
Yes.
No, the people in the know think they lost the war because they lost this battle.
Yes.
That could be really good.
And that could work out well.
You just sold me on Robert's Rebellion. Can we get cheapo Warner Brothers Discovery on the line? That's fucking great.
I have writing credentials. I can bring them to bear. I think that can work if we're the rebel going with us. It is not the Song of Ice and Fire that I've necessarily enjoyed. So much of what George R. R. Martin does is prophecy is almost mocked to a certain degree. Prophecy is something that leads people down roads to tragedy. And I think they could do that well in this narrative, too, to the degree that it feeds into Rhaenyra's megalomania and her obsession with herself and how she has to be the one. That could be well executed if they kind of go in that direction. But if it's instead just, no, this is actual gospel and everyone needs to accept it and everyone needs to be drowned by it, that's the only way they can succeed, that doesn't feel very George R. R. Martin to me. That feels like you make the comparison to Star Wars. I love Star Wars storytelling. I love that epic operatic narrative. But where Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire, House of the Dragon have worked for me best is the individual character stories and their own character flaws driving the story. So much of House of the Dragon, Fire and Blood, that works well for me is the idea of it being a tragedy based on greed, selfishness, self-centeredness, losing track of what the overall purpose is in the overall narrative, and seeing ruin come upon the land as a result. That's a story I like. It's a story you see a lot in Game of Thrones about the own individual character squabbles losing track of the overall picture and to what degree things motivate people and to what degree causes exist beyond them and seeing how those interact and conflict. That's A Song of Ice and Fire to me. It isn't overarching through lines, because so many of those are almost just ultimately mocked. Could the story conclude in that way? Maybe. There's some hints it could, even in the books. But I 100% there with you. The show wants to do that, and I'm eventually going to need to come to terms with it, because it is the narrative they're painting. It just rubs me a little bit wrong at times when we talk about some specific examples that occur this episode, thematically, for what most has invested me otherwise in this world.
It's fair. I hear what you're saying, and I understand it having read the books. I'm not even 100% sold that the battle for humanity is the ultimate point of the Song of Ice and Fire books. I'm not sure.
I don't think so.
Yeah. It's a background thing that we get a little bit of teases about in the books that we have so far. I think if someone else finishes it, it will. I think if someone else finishes it, that's 100% where they'll go. But if Martin were able to finish it, I'm not sure that wouldn't just happen in the background, that like he catch word that like John up north just fucking killed a bunch of strange beasts that came over the wall. And like, that's it. Like, I'm not sure it's going to be the primary end all, but in the show universe, the show canon, it is. I've accepted that. And I like it to a certain extent. I certainly don't like it as much as I like the books. But I was never probably going to like any visual adaptation of that series. I really like the books in part because I don't think that, I think what's gotten lost in a lot of the Westeros discussion is that Martin is a particularly good writer for fantasy. Like, I'm just talking about like a writer, like a person who writes two paragraphs to convey a scene. Guy walks down, sits at table, sees table, talks to woman. Like, those two paragraphs from Martin are going to be better than those two paragraphs from Sanderson or Abercrombie or Rothfuss or any of the other big names you hear in fantasy. He's a good writer. So anytime you're trying to translate somebody who writes pretty darn good prose and good scenes and good dialogue to the screen, you lose a lot of that. It can be disappointing. And they have made this choice of like, we have our chosen one storyline. We have our Battle of the Dawn.
And it's if, Danny, if that's lost you,
I respect that. I get it, but I still am trying to appreciate the show for what it is.
Yeah, I feel like George is unfairly mocked to a certain degree this day and age because his story isn't done, and so people are judging him about that more than they necessarily should fairly judge him about the writing we've gotten. Yes, Lee, in front row.
How long did it take J.R. Tolkien to write Lord of the Rings?
Shut up.
See, this is the thing decades. That always kills.
He got all three of them done at the same time, though. He did. It just took him decades to get there.
That's the thing that always kills that argument with people. It's like, I am also frustrated with Martin. Of course I am. I wish I had the new book. But, like, I always try to remember that, like, the penultimate fantasy series, the thing that started the genre in the modern context, that everyone looks to. I've asked you this question. What's the best fantasy series of all time? And you gave me this, like, weird, like attorney-esque answer of, like, well, you know, some. What did you say? I think you told me a lot of people say it's Lord of the Rings, and I think that title is well-earned.
It's Lord of the Rings.
It's Lord of the Rings, but it took him 20-something years to write it, right?
But he did finish Lord of the Rings and released it. It wasn't just he released Fellowship of the Ring and then 10 years later released Two Towers.
Sure. I get it.
Yeah, but if you want to say he released The Hobbit and then spent 30 years writing Lord of the Rings, fair. I can't say anything about
that. Well, that's because that is what he did.
I planned on writing it.
Yeah, that is what he did. It's a shorter story. I personally don't think of that story as three books. I think of it as one book that the publishers made him break into three books. But you're right. But it did take him decades to finish that. So it's something to remember with Martin. All right. Do you want to finally get into the recap here of this episode?
Excited to, sir.
All right, and at the end of it, we'll do a couple segments. We'll wrap up our talk. If we have time for spoiler talk, we'll do it. I am going to do something slightly different with this recap. I hope it doesn't upset our long-term fans. We've obviously done about 40 minutes now of chatting, and we want to do more of that type of thing. So I am going to not read every single line of the recap. I'm going to go quicker, especially on the scenes that I feel like don't give as much value, and there won't be as much to generate from the discussion of that dialogue. And just so you know, this is going to be a trend on this channel. Like, the more that we do these long reviews, the full coverage, as we call it, the less I'll be doing read every single line of the script like we used to do, and more into, yeah, let's read every line of the script when we feel like that's going to generate important discussion, but where it's, you know, Thailand and Pintos, then probably not. We're probably going to move that a little bit faster, and we'll do. And just a reminder for all of the folks listening that after this episode, Spencer and I will be on break. We're going on break. I can't tell you when we'll be back. I can tell you, felt a little burned out with all the pods I was doing. Also have an actual life and job and work, and it's become too much for me. So I respectfully requested to everybody on the podcast channel, that's Spencer here with Megan Talks TV, that's BJ with Inside Trek, that's Jamie with Megan Talks Star Wars, I need a break. I waved the white flag. So this podcast will be on break until we come back. I can tell you we'll be back at some point for sure. And there are a number of things on the horizon that we know about, that you all have commented to me about. We know Silo's coming back. We know Severance is coming back, and those are very much on our radar. So I can't tell you when we'll be back, but we will be back at some point. So just stay subscribed, and more content will show up in your feed, and it'll be a great surprise. It won't take 2 years, because of the Dragon season. I promise you that. Mm-hmm. All right, we start right out in Nessus with the Tairashi captain negotiating with Thailand. What happens in this sequence is that ultimately he has to promise the stepstones. He has to give them the stepstones, which we spent all of season one fighting about. And we go back to the very basic argument about the stepstones, which is the people trying to assert control over them go, why do you care about that? Just a couple rocks. And the people saying, no, this is a big deal in this point, in this engagement, Thailand, saying, yeah, but it controls all the trade routes, right? It controls all the shipping. And ultimately, he gets a weak promise from the Triarchy to have reasonable taxes and tariffs on the things going through there. Oh, you don't need to worry about that. We'll just put a very simple tax on that. All good. And at the end, they say, okay, great, we got our deal, but you have to gain the favor of, what is this person's name? Lohar?
Admiral Lohar.
Admiral Lohar. You have to gain
for the show writers love, apparently.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
If you watch the after each episode, you get to spend all the time with the director, creator, writer in terms of what they're into. They spend like a couple minutes just talking about how much they loved Lohar as a character. They felt like that she was quintessential George R. R. Martin, that she's colorful, that she adds a bit of necessary comedy, that, you know, that was, they needed some levity in the script, and she fit that role perfectly. They really seem to like this character. And I get a bit of that. Like, you know, we got a Bluebeard Tairoshi in this scene. This felt a bit Essos in terms of what we got, but I understand where they're coming from, but I'm still looking at it saying, you could have cut all this and you probably would have been better off. If you just got a letter back from Thailand, who's not like he's a main character. It's not like we're invested in his journey. We got enough characters to have be point of view. We just got a letter back saying, I negotiated a deal. It kind of sucks. Here's the terms, but a fleet sailing. I think we would have been better off spending the 12 minutes we otherwise have on different plot lines, because Lohar as a character gives nothing for me in terms of like advancing the overall story or just as an investment as a person.
I respect that they're trying to add in some things here. I mean, because the way George told this story, it was a fictional historical text.
They need to fill in the gaps.
Yeah. So they're going to have to add some characters here and there. I respect that they did that. My only, and I like the Lohar character fine. I don't think it's quintessential George R. R. Martin because I don't read Martin's books and like, I don't spend like, you know, they're huge by the way. But if you sit down with like, say Feast of Crows and sit down and go, I'm going to devote an hour to this. I don't spend like the majority of that laughing. Like I'm not saying he's not a funny writer, but I am saying that most of the time I'm reading the books, I'm not laughing. So to say like, oh, we added a bit of levity and silliness here, and that's quintessential George R. R. Martin, to me, doesn't really work. I mean, the one thing I can think of is when he has Tyrion interscene doing like front flips and back flips and whatever in the original Game of Thrones, and he has said that he regrets doing that. He wished that that was not the introduction of that character.
It's also the thing, too, of where there are characters that are like this. Like, the one that they seem like they're referencing is Daru Naharis, like the Bluebeard, Tyroshi kind of, you know, piratey kind of mercenary character. He's also a lot of people's least favorite character in George R. R. Martin's work, is just feeling almost out of place and just this weird mixing of cultural tropes to put in a bit of, you know, variety into the script. So there are aspects of that. They're often people's least favorite aspects in my mind of George R. R. Martin's work, and they are for me, too.
I agree with that. So they that's how they end up. She says, I will not sail with a man who cannot best me in Thailand. Who plays the stiff? He plays a straight man this entire episode. Yeah. Says, at what? And then we cut.
Were you expecting mud wrestling?
No. Hey, look, I live in Asheville, as you know. And across the street, kind of like across the street and a neighborhood, it's like a parallel street to us. There's a bar. There's a very quintessential, like, keep Asheville weird bar. That's yes. Like very, it's colorful.
What's the name of it again?
The Odd is what it's called. And across the street, I read the sign, The Odd, the other night, had a charity event. So shout out to them for doing good work, for like, combating depression. So it was for a good cause.
Yeah.
Lube wrestling. I see this sign the same day I watched this episode. So I'm just thinking, oh man, this is
coming together.
This bar understands the silliness of such a thing to the extent that we'll do it in furtherance of a good, you know, of a good yes. cause. Like we'll do something that's dumb.
Purposefully totally inconsistent.
Right. And this show kind of presents it as, well, this is what, yes, it was funny, but it was also presented as something they've done before. It seems like something yes. in this culture. So I don't know. That was a weak part of the episode. You know, what wasn't a weak part of the episode was Aemon just fucking burning everything on Vhagar, just mad, angry, and just burning. And in this part of the episode, we don't know what he's burning, but because they don't show us much and he doesn't talk.
Yeah. I liked this visual of just Aemon stewing on a ridge, Vhagar happy as a clam because Vhagar's getting to do Vhagar things finally. But just watching a burning town in the distance with almost ambiguous expression on his face after it has occurred. It's just a well-shot little scene of just hearing the screams, seeing the fires, and seeing Aemon and Vhagar looming over all. No dialogue scene.
Really, it was actually scary and sort of foreboding.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what he's doing or why he's doing it. They've absolutely taken out back and shot for the idea that Aemon is a good ruler for all the Aemon stands.
Nope.
So the idea that we were building, which was always tenuous to begin with. I mean, it was just sort of a fun counterpoint. It's dead. It's absolutely deader than dead because he responds to the bad news that it seems like Rhaenyra has more dragon riders for these two very worthy dragons, these two huge dragons that he knew were in Dragonstone. I just burning innocent people. That's just how he deals with it. Like, I just got to relieve a little stress here. Some people get on the exercise bike. You know, some people have a drink at night. I'm going to burn a full city of people.
I mean, could we? I'm willing to presume that the city of, I think it was Sharp Point, that was what he burned.
Sharp Point. Yeah, which is just really close to King's Landing.
Right. It is a scene that was most likely a city that was most likely allied with Rhaenyra. So in like World War II strategic bombing terms, it is a legitimate target. However, it does nothing to further their cause and directly undermines it and just further confirms that Aemon is the bullied kid that got big, and his response to that is to just now be the bully and now it's just punch people and hurt people.
Yeah, it's definitely the on the mainland side, right? It's not an island, yes. But it's But
it's in the Crown Lands that supports her.
But it's on the coast, as you see in the shot. So it's closer, I believe, to Dragonstone than it is to King's Landing, just like as far as physical distance. So it's allied with Rhaenyra. It's not consequential. He had no business doing this. And it gets talked about later. We cut to Orwell and Aegon, and Aegon is asking for some rum, and in comes Larrys. And we have a conversation between Larrys and Aegon that ultimately is about when you have something this catastrophic happen to you mentally, to you physically, that changes who you are physically, but also how you see yourself in the world. What is the reason to go on?
Yes.
That's ultimately the question here. Is what is Aegon's reason to go on? Because if he's going to go on, Larrys explains, you're going to have to leave because it looks like Rhaenyra has found three new riders for her dragons. Your brother, Aegon says that's impossible. Larrys, your brother thought the same. He flew to challenge her and was rebuffed. Fled in terror from what I hear. Aegon, well, I like that. Larrys, be that as it may, he's gone in fury to Sharppoint. So that's where you're about Sharppoint. Laid waste to the whole of the town. Aegon speaking for all the audience, fucking mad cunt. She really did that then, Larrys, I fear so. And Aegon, so what was the fucking point in all this? Larrys is like, you gotta leave, you gotta get out of here, you're in danger. And not only is your brother angry and you're in danger of him, you're in danger because now Rhaenyra has military might that will allow her to walk into the city any point she wants to.
Right.
At least that's what Larrys believes. And he's telling Aegon, you got to leave. And Aegon just kind of responds with, do I really have to? Like, I don't know that I care that much. Do you want to take me to Essos to live with the goat fuckers? Larrys, it's best to live, I think, however you do it. Aegon, is it? My dragon is dead. I am burnt and disgusting and alone, and I'm a cripple. Larrys, you are not alone. I'm literally standing in front of you.
Yeah.
Aegon says, my cock is destroyed. Did they tell you that? Now, that's a tough line to hear. And he talks about it being burst into flames like a sausage on the spit. That's tough. But I also think there's a significance to this because he's saying, I can't have an heir. So Aemon will always be my heir. And so, yes, I can't have the joy in life of having, you know, having sex or having a wife, procreating, having more children, whatever. I guess he could have a wife, and he has one. But like having physical intimacy with someone, but then also, you know, repopulating a family. He can't do that. But he's also saying, this fucking maniac is always going to be my heir if I stay king. And they start talking about ways that he can come back. Hey, Larrys is like, hey, this is – Larrys is obviously thinking this is a way that I can motivate him to keep living. You'll come back. You'll leave. You'll come back. You'll be hailed as Aegon the Victorious, Aegon the Peacemaker. Aegon, the rebuilder. Aegon, the greenlighter of season 3 and 4 of the show with sufficient budget. Aegon, the creator of the new Harry Potter series that will have sufficient amounts of money. Aegon, the true executive that we need. And he says, Aegon, the realm's delight, which tells us a lot. It's draw from the books because it's Rhaenyra. That's what Rhaenyra was always called. And he was called that. She was called that at the urging of Aegon's father, Viserys. And I think it just gives us a clue that Aegon being ignored as much as he was as a child did hurt him and has stayed with him.
Yeah, I adore this scene. I adore what they've done with Aegon's character. Aegon's character feels like the most complete and realized character of the entire damn season. In a way, I did not see that coming because he actually has a character arc.
Tomlin Kearney.
Tomlin Kearney.
Goat of acting.
I'm going to be with you on this. He's done wonderfully, but particularly the writers have done wonderfully with him, of where he's got a story. He has a narrative. He has an arc he's gone on. And we get to see a lot of it summarized in this scene of where, you know, he originally goes, well, I got Vhagar still. I can just arrest Aemon. And he's like, and Larrys pointed out, if you do that, you have no weapons whatsoever to resist Rhaenyra. So that's not even an option. And then he goes through the sense of loss of however he's built himself on or not. You know, I'm not pretty anymore. I don't have a dragon anymore. I don't have any basis of leadership. I'm basically, from his perspective, not a man anymore. And all of those are being, you know, things he's having to come to terms with the loss of, because they were all the things he built up around himself. He was going to be the magnanimous. He was going to be the conqueror. He was going to be, you know, a dragon rider. He was going out to brothels all the time. These were so much of his character that have now been just forcibly, traumatically, horrendously stripped away from him. And his perspective, like you said, is, I got nothing now. What's the point? And Larry's perspective is, you're alive and you're here in front of me and there's a future if you want to have it. Their relationship has been so wonderfully well done because it gives me such an interesting perspective on Larry's of where I think Larry's is manipulating him to a certain degree. I think Larry's is using him as a basis to power. But I would struggle to maintain an argument after watching this whole season and seeing the scene that he also isn't just invested in Larry's in Aegon is a person that he commiserates with, as a person he wants to see succeed as much as he himself wants to succeed. He's a twisted version of Alice Rivers now working on Daemon. And I believe it, and I like it, and I think it's been wonderfully done this season and in this scene as well.
I think it's easy to forget in this scene that Larry's is a bad guy.
But he is, but also many other things.
He's turned slightly babyface in this situation, in part because he is internalizing Aegon's struggle to his own.
Yes.
The struggle of the physically disabled. And that is something that he's clearly taken to heart. So that's more George R. R. Martin than
100%
Lohar is, because it is people being gray and complicated. This person that has done all of these awful, terrible things, Jamie Lannister, ends up having motivations that are very human that start to explain some of the actions that you've seen, and actually has parts of their personality that you end up liking, so you really can't slot them into that heel or babyface role. And that's what we've got with this character, and it is quintessential A Song of Ice and Fire storytelling.
Aegon and Larry's done in this show are almost in some ways more George than George gave them in the text, in terms of just what complete, gray, complicated characters that you want to hate and root for in equal measure depending on what scene you're in. That is George done at his most perfect, and that's something I think the show has accomplished quite well when it comes to these two.
Yeah, we agree. Then we have a scene with Ulf and Hugh where they're at the map room. Jace comes in. Jace jumps in. Whole point of this scene is to show the tension between Ulf and Jace, and Hugh sort of being a uncomfortable bystander to it all. Yeah, he's conflicted about it. He clearly wants to be with and support his other dragon riders, but he sees the problem in Ulf's behavior.
I feel like it's realistic to see how differently Ulf and Hugh have gone about their now new positions in the world. Of where we always just saw Hugh as being a more family man, a more humble individual, an individual also who's more has more experience in interacting with the nobility and the societal complexities that go into that. Whereas Ulf is coming across as just being like the recent lottery winner, like, you know, come from a poor area. He's now has a $1 million ticket, and he's just acting it up because he now can in a way that he felt like he never could before. So the two characters are experiencing their newfound proverbial wealth or metaphorical wealth in very different ways, in a way that it strikes as realistic to me, and I like that there's tensions that are occurring with respect to that. And I hope they go more into that as time goes on, because that seems an interesting route they can do for these plots.
We agree. There is a thing that happens to Hugh in the book. One of Hugh's storylines. Let's not spoil it. I think you know what I'm talking about. I think they're giving it to Ulf.
I 100% think they're giving it to Ulf, and it makes me very interested about what they're going to do with Hugh's storyline if they're cleaving a lot of it out and now assigning it to Ulf by comparison. That could work. That could work very well. I'm with you that I feel like the first hints of that are now starting to occur.
So then we cut to Rhaenyra, who is talking to the Sea Snake, and she's just saying, hey, look, I got the new riders. Mm-hmm. It's not great. I'm going to tell you, it's not great right now, but I got the riders. And we do have one who looks pretty good, Adam of Hull. You know him. And Sea Snake says something interesting to me where he says, I've had little to do with him to my regret. So he's throwing in a little hint of truth there, as Spencer is wont to do from time. Spencer will give you those time to time. Just throw in a little
hint of humanity.
Just a little ditty there to tell you where his head's really up. And I could talk about it explicitly. And Rhaenyra goes on to talk about how Vhagar is now overmatched. And Sea Snake goes, well, it's not the only dragon. And they discuss the fact that Helaena herself is a dragon rider on Dreamfire. Mm-hmm. Dreamfire, of course, she explains, was born hatched when the Conqueror was king. So Dreamfire is older.
Elder dragon.
So Helena did not, this was not one hatched in Helena's crib. Helena claimed Dreamfire. And they'd go on to discuss that Aemon himself discovered that he was desperate. He'll not stop at Burning Sharp Point, and he will not be denied. That was the Sea Snake, and he's right about that, I think. Rhaenyra says, speak truly, though I wish it was not. And then she asked about the ship, the Sea Snake, right? Because you can't have a ruler without the name Aegon. It's got to have the original ruler's Aegon, current ruler's Aegon, the son's Aegon, the kid's Aegon. The head of Driftmark is a Sea Snake, but the boat also has to be the Sea Snake, right? That's how he tells the story.
Yes, tradition.
So the boat is the Sea Snake, but they're going to help clear up some of these lines because they go on to explain that he's renamed it. It's not the Sea Snake anymore. He now calls it the Queen Who Never Was after his, deceased wife.
I like this scene because it's a scene I wish we'd gotten earlier of where this is Corlys actually being an advisor to Rhaenyra in a way that I feel like she needed in episode 3. Of where he's effectively telling her to consider her position, that you have all the advantages and you can't count on your enemies just accepting that and being idle. They have a dragon in the form of Vhagar. They have Tessarion. He's tiny, whatever. They have the potential with Dreamfires, but she would dismiss it that maybe Helen is not a dream, is not a dragon rider.
I don't dismiss it.
His position basically is you need to act. You have a winning hand now. And you've been sitting the entire season not even putting together cards. By miracle, the cards have come to you. If you don't play them now, everything is lost. And she's still fighting to a certain degree. It's like, I don't want it to be true, but I acknowledge it's true. But he's finally actually being a bit of a military and political advisor to her in a way he's been otherwise kind of sidelined this season because they didn't want Rhaenyra to get that advice too early, I guess. I feel like most of Corlys' plot this season has been him standing in front of a boat. Think about Corlys' seats the entire season. Most of them have been on this dock in front of this boat.
I don't hate that. I think people hate it because of the length of the season. And they feel like, why are we spending so much time with this?
Sure.
But this is what this character would be doing. He'd be mourning and stewing and thinking and wondering what his life is. It's parallel to what Aegon's going through. It's not as immediately physically severe, but it's wondering, where do I fit in now? My life's been turned upside down. So fair. I don't mind this. This is basically Aegon at bedside wondering aloud, where how he's going to go on. This is what he's doing at the docks. So people who made fun of him at the docks every week with Alice or Alan, like, I don't know. I think that makes sense for the story. I agree. I wish the overall story was longer. That's a different complaint, but I like that they included this.
I think it's a good scene, and I don't mind the scenes of the docks. I just wish we'd gotten a bit more with respect to this character, similar to this thing. This is a great scene in terms of expressing a lot of that. The scene we get later of him, finally actually having a talk with his bastard son, one of his bastard sons, is a great scene. Give me more of that. Give me more of the focus of that, because there's such good scenes to feel like they're not happening at the bitter end of it all.
Is that the best? When Alan fires back at him and goes, I'm gonna tell you what I really think here about how you treat us. Is that the thing of this episode?
For me, yeah. It's just such a well-acted and powerful scene. I love that confrontation. I love that conversation is happening, and it's so beautifully delivered. It's at least top 3 for me this episode.
We agree. Back to the recap. Oh, one other cool thing they talk about is they talk about how... he explains for her a hands roll, right? This is, I think, it's okay thing for him to do. He says, "Your Grace, you are ready. You have 6 dragons under your banner. Let's count them, Spencer. Let's count the 6 dragons. Can we do it?"
I think we can.
All right.
We have got.
Okay. So we've got
Syrax. We've got Ding. Vermithor. We've got Vermithor.
Ding.
We've got Silverwing.
Ding.
We've got Vermax.
Ding.
We've got Moondancer.
Ding.
And we've got Sea Smoke, and I don't even think he's counting Caraxes then.
He's not, right? And so
or Joffrey's dragon, or the little ones, yeah.
Yeah, she's really got 7, basically, that can fly and fight. It's a hell. She has a hell of an arsenal right now. It's very impressive. When you add Caraxes into that, it's... It's wild. So he says, "You have six dragons on your banner. My ships sail at your command, and my men serve you. But the Lannisters are marching the high towers from Old Town. You must crush this beast at its head before too many days have flown." And then he mentions Daemon, and we cut the scene.
Yep. That was an excellent scene. I feel like it's almost more than anything else that Rhaenyra's gotten this season. It feels like this is the one that finally pushes her to, "My queen, you're at war. Act like it. Use the resources you have to fight the enemy. Otherwise, as much as they're now behind the eight ball, they'll catch up in a way that you can't bring back. Act. Otherwise, other people will act instead of you and for you."
We get Daemon at the Riverlands, and he's chatting with one of the River Lords, who is telling him, "Hey, we feed you dragon. I don't really know how to do that." Just kind of talking logistics. And comes on and strong. Right. Says, "They're out for Broom to come." Daemon laughs at that. And Broom says, "I'm an emissary from the queen to ascertain your movements and your intentions." They go off to talk alone. And Broom, fucking turncoat that he is, says that he actually supports Daemon. He doesn't think Rhaenyra is ready for rule. In the moment, this is for her to prop up Daemon as the actual monarch of the Blacks. And my interpretation of this is that Daemon was entertaining that, but, you know, I think we're all open to other interpretations. It seems not particularly clear, but it seems like to me that Daemon was thinking about that. And I'd make that determination based on his reaction in the moment, but also his insistence throughout this entire season that people call him king, not king consort, and that the men were sworn to him. So it seems like this is all a part and parcel. Part and parcel of him considering the thoughts about who should be actually ruling the Blacks.
Yeah, it feels like it's hitting the nail on the head when it comes to, again, the central tension that's been for him about motivations, about what does he want out of this? Does he want to make his own claim? Does he want to usurp Rhaenyra? Does he want to make her a co-ruler? Can he emotionally submit to her? This is the final temptation, as it were, of where Broom's offering him what, before the last couple episodes, was what he expressed was his goal. Now, I feel like the ultimate vision he had is, it may have been, you know, the final straw, it may have been the final thing that pushed him over, but I almost feel like his reaction from this scene is almost amused at the idea of this is what he would have wanted, but now it no longer is.
Yeah, I don't know the purpose of the scene at the Weirwood. If you think he's already gotten there, then I don't know why they threw that in. Now the response from you can be, yeah, I agree, they shouldn't have thrown it in. But they obviously put it in for a reason. I think they're trying to tell you that that did change him in some way.
I think this is a scene that is almost more offering some, I'm with you. They want there still to be some tension. I feel like this scene is meant to still build that tension to the audience that there is still a risk, that there is still an idea that Rhaenyra's advisors are turning against her. Daemon could seize upon that. Daemon could act upon that. For me, at least, from the last few scenes, I'm looking at this going, well, Daemon's not going to do that, because I've seen the last few scenes. I've seen how much he's been affected by the scenes with his brother and Rhaenyra previously. But I'm not the audience. I'm not the writers. I could fully understand how people could see the prior scenes and not in any way be convinced, much less certain, much less even confident, that Daemon's going to go in one direction or another. And this scene adds to the tension of that to then go into the Weirwood scene.
Well, you are the audience.
I'm of smallest of small components of the audience.
You're as much of the audience as any other one person speaking. So yeah, I don't know. I think they were leading us to the scene at the Weirwood does change him in some way. I would be with you, I think, if he doesn't reference the conversation to Rhaenyra as the reason for his actions.
Which he specifically does, fully acknowledge that.
I agree, though, that it's not a one-time seismic event. This has been building. That Alice has been, this is like the last lecture in, you know, being a human 101 that she's made him sit through, the seminar class she's made him sit through. She has been teaching him, you know, how to be the man that he should be in this whole conflict, and what he could be. she's been teaching him how to connect his humanity with the relationships that he does care about. And this is the scene at the werewood is a part of it, but it's not the only part of it.
And I think another importance to this scene as well is confirming the magic is real, because
oh yeah,
when Broom walks into this scene and he's talking, he tells Damon he basically wants to, you know, support his cause instead of Rhaenyra's. We openly hear the whispers of traitor through the weirwood, and Broom hears it. He hears it, and he's affected by it, and he's scared by it for a second. And Damon just seems almost amused that Broom can hear it, because it confirms in his mind, oh, I'm not crazy. Gotcha. Understand. That felt important, too, even independent of the temptation or whatever else, that it's a necessary little bit of showing, you know, revealing to the audience that, oh, shit, this isn't just, you know, someone messing with his head. This is actual magic in the world, and other people can be influenced and affected by it, too.
Yeah. I like that Damon responds, like, ah, you'll go crazy in this place. It very much was reminiscent of what Larry's said in the small council meeting, where he goes, he'll go mad there if he stays there too long. So you almost wonder, could the show give us a little novella of what Larry's experienced when he was at Harrenhal? Maybe that changed him when he went back to the council in King's Landing. He certainly has seemed less severe this season than in previous seasons.
It's curious what degree he has been molded by Alice or is otherwise resisting from her. We don't know, but I'm with you. The idea that he specifically referenced it in that way, and he was a resident there before, and he's seemingly turned against his own family and set his own objectives, I don't think it's much of a leap to say that Alice at least attempted to act on him, and that is relevant to his character.
Cut to Jasper, Iron Rod Wild, and dummy-ass Aemon, who... Aemon in this conversation says, yeah, well, we'll just cut off, let no vessel come or go from our harbor without our inspection.
Oh.
And Rod's like, so that you mean you're going to cut off fishing too?
Hang on.
We've heard the few representatives of the small folk of King's Landing that we have in this series mention that they're eating nothing but fish right now. So he's going to cut that off too. And he goes, well, everybody's got to make our sacrifices. And we cut. So Aemon just missing the mark completely.
Yeah, you want further proof that Aemon's the worst? His basic solution to, you know, the starvation in King's Landing is, let's double down on that shit so I have even more control. Aemon, do you understand people? I don't think you do. I don't think you have any read on what the people are going through and how they will react if you're actually able to enforce this.
Making the mistake of so many people born into privilege and high privilege of underestimating people who were not born into privilege.
And it's wrapped up into some of the same delusion we see aspects of in Rhaenyra as well, is that, I'm a Targaryen, I've got a dragon, therefore I get to do whatever the hell I want. And the people will just get in line because I'm a Targaryen, I'm better for that reason, and also I'm a dragon rider, which makes me even better among Targaryens. So people will submit to me because I'm bigger.
And Helena and Alicent in a really good scene.
Yes.
Where Helena, I like everything about this Helena character. She's so good. And I'm glad they didn't make her just a bumbling mess like she was in the books after Blood and Cheese.
In the book.
She's really good in this scene. And she's a great actress. I'm stealing every scene for me as Helena. I'm really liking it. Mm-hmm. So she's like, why does everybody hate us? Allison, they're unhappy, and unhappy people look for something to hate. We didn't order the blockade. No, but we're the crown, so they expect us to break it, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
Drink this. I don't know what she's handing her to drink. That was strange. Helena goes, I was happier before I was queen. And this sort of heartbreaking line. Allison says, how about we get out of here? And she goes, where will we go? And in comes Kingsguard and Aemon. And Aemon tries to drag her out of the room, saying, I need you to fly with Dreamfire to battle. She goes, I don't wish to fight. And he goes, our wishes must take second place now to what is necessary to preserve the throne. She goes, I won't burn anyone. And he goes, it isn't a question. As he's continuing to yank her, Allison is trying to stop him, grabbing Helena, trying to pull her back. It's just like a literal tug of war for one of the dragon riders that they have. You have Aemon pulling her toward, you know, his desires, the sense of duty, preserving the green cause. And then you have Allison pulling back Helena and some measure of her humanity, which is what we've seen from Helena the entire series, is this through line of not being she's not a bad person, right? She's not somebody with these cruel streaks like her brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And we end with Alicent pointedly referencing to Aemon about what he did at Sharp Point, and says, "You wish to rule the Seven Kingdoms, but you rain rule and you rain ruin and death upon its small folk when you've been insulted, because it makes you feel strong. And now you seek to corrupt your sister of all our line, the gentlest and most deserving of your protection." Saying, you're doing the opposite of what you should be doing here to Aemon. You should be protecting her, and instead you're asking her to become you. And he says, what if she can't protect herself? And Alicent goes, well, hell, you're gonna break who she is, so that doesn't matter. And Aemon says this in the scene, would you not have us prevail? Alicent says, not like this, not like this.
And I like how Aemon grounds it in that if we don't prevail, we're dead. It's like, it's no longer a rule that's threatened. Our very lives are under threat here, Mom. We have to fight, otherwise we're going to lose everything. Are you okay with that? And she effectively says that if it means the realm's going to die for our own ambition, yeah, I'm okay with that. And I feel like there's a fundamental break between Aemon and Alicent in this scene. To the degree they had any relationship before, now Aemon's looking at her like, then we can never meet again. We can never see eye to eye again if that's where you've gotten to, because I'll burn the world if it gets me another day alive, whereas you will happily see us all offered up if you feel it's the morally right thing to do. We can never meet on these issues again.
I do think that they view the outcome that they're talking around, which is the Greens losing this battle,
yes,
losing this war, differently. Like, I think ultimately, it seems to me, that Aemon believes they will all be killed.
Yes.
Everyone in the family, everyone
very much believes
on the green side will be executed for this. And Alicent clearly, in her conversation with Rhaenyra later, does not think that that's an obvious eventuality. She thinks there's space for Rhaenyra to pardon some of them, to let some of them live, let some of them go. She asks for it. She seems to expect it in that conversation. So I think one thing I think that they're not doing here is talking specifically about what they're worried about. They're talking very vague about what they're worried about.
But part of that's been driven as well is that Alicent has met with Rhaenyra. Alicent has a read on Rhaenyra, or at least exposure to, you know, an inner Rhaenyra, that Aemon fundamentally lacks. And I feel like part of where she's coming to with this conversation is, this is a woman who traveled to King's Landing to meet with me for the hope of peace. This is someone who wanted to negotiate. This is someone, therefore, I can negotiate with. Whereas Aemon is just looking at the data points on the surface because he has nothing else to turn to about, this is a woman who sent an assassin into our home. This is a woman who's fighting us. This is a woman who's putting together dragons to confront us. This is a war. I don't have any other choice but this. Along with, I would rather die and see other people die rather than give up the throne as well. But Rhaenyra told everybody she met with Alicent. Alicent has not told anybody, it seems, that she met with Rhaenyra, and that is an insight that everybody else lacks by comparison.
Agreed. So we got to Orwell and Alicent. She says, hey, look, I got to get out of here and I need your help. And that's the end of that scene.
And so she does.
And then we have one of your favorite scenes of the episode. Do you want to talk
about this season? I very much adored this scene of where it's a quiet little scene of where last we heard Cole and his army are marching north, presumably to Harrenhal. That seems to be where the Greens army is coalescing, or trying to coalesce. That is, Vhagar eventually is going to fly there. Cole's marching an army there. Some allies, maybe they think in the Riverlands, are going to meet there. Who the hell knows? But that's the direction that they're marching in. And so for a quiet moment while the march is occurring, Gwaine, who has clearly been stewing on this for a minute, basically puts a knife or a sword to Cole's throat and effectively threatens him on the subject of, you've been fucking my sister, and I'm pissed about it. And Cole, I think we agreed the term nihilistic really applies to his character throughout what we've seen now, right?
Post Rook's Rest, yes.
That his response to this is,
he had a touch of it before, but it's been like exacerbated.
Yes. He's always had a certain element of, you know, willing to risk all, having death looming, a certain degree of powerlessness things. This season has been a bit of a depressed Cole from where events have been headed. Episode, since Rook's Rest, that's so much of his character is that kind of trauma and that feeling sense. But his response is to openly just admit the crimes, I do with air quotes, that he's being accused of here, is that, you know, just that she's broken no oath. She, if anything, has saved me. That, you know, you can say, as Gwaine confronts him with, that, you know, I'm the steward, I'm fucking the queen of the Seven Kingdoms. I've stained my cloak, everything else, former Quinn. And, you know, you could send me the wall for Broken Oath, whatever else. But you'll sell your sister at the same time. You'll sell you the Hightower name at the same time. When, from my perspective...
You'll become public.
Yeah, and everyone will suffer for it. When, from my perspective, you really... It almost becomes, you know, we've been debated what his actual feelings are of her for whatever else, whether they're just a fling, whatever else. He speaks of her in very almost worshipping terms that, you know, she saved my life twice, you know, Headman's axe and once for myself. She's the beacon I follow. I think it's the exact language he uses that, you know, you can talk about, you know, shame and whether I can resist women, to which Gwen accused and be like, should resist if your brothers are resisting it. You know, that's something you could be doing. But his perspective has really now become that, you know, following her, she's really what I aspire to. But more than anything else, my philosophy is that men are fundamentally corrupt and that any concept of honor, as he's expressed, that true honor is a mist that melts in the morning. He doesn't even have a philosophy at this point. It used to be to protect the righteous and dispense justice and all the rest, but now... To quote him, the dragons dance and men are like dust under their feet, and all our fine thoughts, all our endeavors are as nothing. Good God, is that Macbeth? Good God, is that Nietzsche? It is well delivered. It is effective. It ends with, we march now towards our annihilation. To die will be a kind of relief, don't you think? You and I talked about season one that we thought the Cole actor was a little bit weak, that he didn't necessarily work for us as well. He's put on his A-game this season. And this line, this delivery, and how much it fits for what the character has now gone through and the journey he's been on. We talked about how much we liked Aegon for the arc he's been working with. Here's an arc for Cole, and it works for me quite well. And I love the relationship that has been building now between him and Gwen, as we're seeing now to a Lord Commander, a Hand of the King, and, you know, a brother, a son of a noble family, going off to war for the original motivations, but now having fought in it, how it has affected them, and how, in some ways, despite the tensions, it's drawn them closer together because of the shared trauma they're enduring. This is a great scene. I love it. Some wonderful dialogue and some wonderful delivery.
I do like that Gwen points out, I got a weakness for women.
Yeah.
And Gwen is like, Gwen gets his Kendrick Lamar. He's like, look, that's the yam. Spencer, Bill Clinton with desires. Talked about in all modern media. And then we move on to a wonderful display of nihilism, like definitely like pre-Jurgenov. It's like, it hasn't been named yet, but it's like nothing matters. We're all dust in the wind here with the dragons. And I like that there was an eventual character that got there, because I feel like I was always there with this story. When I was reading Fire and Blood, I was like, oh, well, just whoever has the biggest dragon is going to win. Like, none of this matters. And I've heard a lot of that online. I've heard a lot of, like, people are Cole sympathizers and they don't fucking know they're Cole sympathizers, because they're online going, why does the Riverlands matter at all? Why does it matter who has an army here, army there? A dragon's just going to burn the whole fucking thing anyway. And I'm like, oh, big Kristen Cole fan, are we? Okay, cool. Because that's exactly what his mind is. So it's these two incredibly human things he's discussing here, which is the yam, which we established earlier. You know all about this, which is that I have a weakness for the opposite sex, the fair sex, the sex that I am interested in. I have a weakness for that. And that has pervaded every bad decision of my life, something that Cole is dealing with, a very human element, right? We've seen this a lot. And then we also have I feel weak. Looking at this greater power, I feel like I can't take on this greater power. I feel less than, and so therefore I'm giving up. Nothing matters. Two very human emotions here coming out from Cole.
Yeah, I feel like we're also going to understand his, you know, his personal kinks. Apparently, the guy's just into queens, which, you know, makes his career choice a very fulfilling one, that he was able to get in this circumstance of where queens could be his ultimate, you know, forbidden fruit that he could actually take a bite out of.
I enjoy that on the podcast we say he's into queens, and we actually just mean ladies who are married to kings who rule kingdoms. Like, we don't actually mean what you might expect with that phrase.
My phrase was accurate, and I'm proud of it.
The little used literal. He's into Queens. You don't hear that much in 2024. Yet I liked everything about this, and I tell you that of all the characters they've introduced this season, Gawain is my favorite.
I feel like they reintroduced
Missaria, and her reintroduction was really good. But Gawain is definitely probably my favorite new character they've introduced. Sorry, go ahead.
No, 100% agree with you. Gawain is a fundamentally great character, and I've loved what they've done with him in terms of the scene that he's been in, how he interacts with other people. And his scene with Alicent, the episode back, my favorite of the entire season. The scene with Cole, same deal. And even the little ones he just interpreted in terms of background dialogue, like when he's riding with Cole with, you know, the head of the Red Queen there behind him. He has improved each scene he has been in, and that is well executed. Because Gawain exists in the books, but he is a footnote of a footnote, practically. He exists to have a couple references that are made to him. He is a fully realized character here, and he is an awesome addition for that reason.
It's the yam, Spencer. The yam is the power that be. You smell it when you're walking down the street. Everybody knows that. We go from one of the best scenes of the episode to one of the worst. We get the mud
wrestling.
So they wrestle in the mud, and Thailand, I guess, like comes to like an easy, friendly truce with Lohar. She goes, okay, well, I'll consider your request to dinner.
What was the point of it, even just from, like, you know, a fighting standpoint? This felt like it was theater within theater, because he gets, like, one punch in, and she's like, oh, now you've impressed me. So, yeah, we're all good. What? Did she just want a mud wrestle? Is this just her kink? It's like, we're talking about character motivations. It's just, she wanted to use any excuse possible to mud wrestle with people? Because it doesn't seem like does anything to get her around.
I certainly got vibes from her. That she was very, very personal with Thailand very quickly. Unfortunately, I think the mud wrestling likely can be explained by we, the writers, thought it was funny. And also, even if they're not overtly aware of it, playing into stereotypes about tribal cultures.
Yeah. It's part of the reason I often don't like how the shows have depicted Essos, of where it feels all sorts of cultural tropey in terms of how they depict the foreign. And this is what they're intentionally trying to do here, of where they put a stiff Westerner, as you will, literally in this case, in the form of Thailand, because he is the most stiff that they have on the show, and they push him out of his comfort zone and make him deal with all of the weird exoticism that they're now inserting him into. And they deem that funny. I deem it kind of eye-rolling for most of it.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, when you're trying to create other cultures in fantasy, it's hard to create something that people can't say is tropey. Because, like, you're having a sort of pick from human existence unless you can create something new. And if you can, shout out, because I can't. So you have to sort of pick from the palette of human existence. You have to grab something. And then people can go, oh, well, that's just derivative of, pre-Northern Ireland independence island. Where, you know, like, you could just pick time period.
Anything you can draw from,
you could just some vague period in history, some very specific period of history from some very specific area, and then you could say it's derivative, and it sounds like you're crushing it, but ultimately, everything in fantasy is that to some extent or the other.
Yeah.
But I'd say that, like, the more overt you get on that scale, the more problematic it becomes from an entertainment perspective. Forget, like, any sort of, like, social criticism of the show or, like, the responsibility of storytelling. I think it just becomes not that interesting to watch, right? If I've got something where it's a fantasy world and the guy has a sombrero on, and he's eating a taco, and it's very hot outside, and he's in the desert.
That's a hat. I would go, okay.
Right. I'm not, like, upset with you. I'm just bored, and that's kind of where the mud wrestling fell for me.
It felt like a lower budget show that was inserted into this. Like, they had a C team that didn't have as much money. They needed to, make some filming, and they draw that C team from the CW in terms of, like, overall production. It wasn't bad. It was fine enough, but it stands out among the rest as being inconsistent and lower quality.
Yeah. That's all we need to say on that. We cut to Bela and Jace, and Bela has to give yet another hype speech to Jace. Yet another, like, get him in the locker room and get him motivated again. And she's telling him not to pout. And he says, well, I'm just reading. And she goes, well, your mother waits. You're angry. He goes, aren't you? And she goes in a tone that is, like, really soft and tepid and almost, like, full of she's empathetic for him. Says, I don't see what good it would do. Jace says, they're an insult to us, to what makes us Targaryen. If any common lout can ride a dragon, then... And she goes, that doesn't make me common. She's like, fires back at him. Like, you don't put me in that. If that's how you view yourself, fine. But I'm uncommon because I'm uncommon, not because I drive out a dragon necessarily. She explains, you're the crown prince, the son of the rightful queen. And here you are skulking because you believe that if not for the dragon or the trappings of your station, that you are nothing. Do you believe that you're the first noble heir who was not sired by his noble bastard? Spitting fucking T-bombs here.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Bela's pointed out, look, this shit happens all the time. Why are you going to make yourself the martyr in that situation? Like, it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. People inherit the kingdom when their parentage is just questionable. You need to just get that out of your mind and just roll forward. And he says, that's easy enough to say. And she goes, then prove to them that you are worthy. Get up and take your place by your mother's side.
Yeah. It's a good scene. I like that. We talked about how much we like the relationship these two characters have, and it's another scene that reinforces it, that so rarely in the show do we see two people that are in a relationship, are married, are lovers, whatever else, have an honest conversation with each other. We get to see it a few times between Rhaenys and Corlys, but even the two of them have barriers and clear things that they don't talk about. I feel like these two, said it before, and this just reaffirms it, have the healthiest relationship in the overall show, which is mostly a collection of twisted, toxic, broken relationships, but these two look like they're legitimately happy and have a future together, and I'm here for it.
Agreed. And then we get Tywin singing. So that's great.
Yeah, it's a thing. That does happen.
Yeah, and ultimately Lohar agrees to sail with him. So he's got the commitment that he needs from the Triarch. Now, it's going to be weird coming back and saying, I gave away the Stepstones, but I think the Greens are in such a desperate position now that you're not going to get a lot of argument probably from Aemon or Aegon, depending on who's ruling at the time. They're down on their knees, the Greens are definitely in second place in this deal right now. And so he's done something really helpful to their cause in getting the Triarchy to come over. This ends with her saying, I'd like you to father my children, but apparently not by her, with her wives. And I think that all is meant to be funny, and I was just sort of bored by it. What about you?
Same thing entirely. The thing I found most interesting was Tywin's concerns about, he's negotiated a useful deal for the Greens, particularly in the short term. He's given them a force that they otherwise can't survive without. But his main concern is assuming he's going to be executed for what he's selling off for this. So he has to keep repeating to everybody else involved, when we get there, you're going to speak for me. This is a great deal, right? You're going to do something to help me keep my head. Because his presumption, we can debate to what degree it's just he knows Aemon, and Aemon is a big head cutter kind of dude, or what he's giving away is just particularly sensitive among the people he's been working with, given the prior wars they've fought with it. But as much as we can talk about what he's doing is offering hope in a war effort that's otherwise done, his presumption is that he will not survive bringing this fleet back to Westeros. And that I find more interesting than all of the shit with him singing and people laughing and him now banging all of her wives.
I think that it continues to be more reinforcement about how stiff, overly cautious, conservative he is, that he's so worried about this. But he also doesn't know that the Greens have been knocked down a peg or two by the additional dragon riders, right? Like, so he doesn't know how bad a spot they're in. That's actually fortunate for his short-term personal position, because when he gets back, they're going to go, oh, thank God, I'm glad you did that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a dinner party that I'd invite Spencer. I'm not sure I would go to it, but I would like to see you at it for sure.
I would be very much the hue of this dinner party, just nonstop, unable to control my embarrassment that the buddy I brought, Ulf, is just making an embarrassing racket at all opportunity. Because the point of this dinner party is to again show that there's tension, and so there's difficulty, and that she's trying to up-jump these two, and as much as Jace is on his mom's side, he's clearly struggling with that, as is Rhaenyra and the room, that these are the people that she's looking to up-jump. And it serves that purpose, but I almost felt awkward even watching it to see Ulf just have nothing resembling the niceties of etiquette that are necessary to otherwise make it through this kind of dinner party. But, you know, at least he's got a sufficient supply of little birds to offer, to receive.
One of the things that Rhaenyra has been okay at as a ruler is being flexible. A lot of times, yes, these like single rule monarchs, they're down. Fall is always that they're inflexible.
Yes.
And she's shown some flexibility. And I was a little disappointed in the character that we didn't get more of that. I would have probably tossed this idea out in the writing room of what about the idea that when Ulf is getting very kind of drunk and personal and overly familiar, what if Rhaenyra just downed a goblet of wine and kicked her feet up on the same table and said, okay, what do you want to talk about? Like, it actually changed her vibe. To match it. No one else at the table will, right? Like, Jace will bristle, Bela will bristle, everyone will, but Rhaenyra will continue to show that flexibility of like, okay, culture's changed. I need to kind of meet it differently. Here's my attempt at that.
I would have found that very interesting because it would have actually been a successful strategy to get Ulf into her camp to meet him as a drinking buddy, to actually interact with him in that kind of way. And she could have threaded it into the same thing that she ends with about, you know, we're buddies, we're drinking buddies. You ever disrespect me in front of other people again, I'll fucking cut you and then pour him another glass of wine. And that could have actually gotten him more in her camp than anything else that she could have done. We don't get that. We instead, the tension persists, the difficulty persists, and that seems to be something that they more are interested in going in. But I'm with you that if any of the leaders we see, whatever else, would have been willing to do that, I'll draw that back. Daemon would have done that. Daemon unquestionably would have done that. It would have been interesting to see how much she has been coming around to Daemon's understanding and camp and philosophy, to see whether Rhaenyra at the end of the season would have been doing that in the way that Rhaenyra at the start of the season wouldn't.
Yeah, it's just disappointing they didn't go that route with her, because instead she shows the classic inflexibility of a single monarch of, well, we have rules, decorum, you're not meeting that, so I will argue with you about that. Or have tension with you about that, then what we really are here for, which is to defeat the Greens, right?
And her plan for defeating the Greens is interesting.
Yeah. She says, you got to learn your beast and your commands. You will fly in 2 days' time. The strongholds of the usurper, Old Town and Lannisport, and their armies all must be subdued alone, without allies. He will have no choice but to surrender. Bela's like, when Bela's questioned this type of thing, you've done fucked up. Because Bela says, wait, you want us to kill innocents? And he's like, in so many. And Jace goes, it is hard, but it cannot be helped. So Jace was in on this plan that she was going to, you know, debut here at dinner. But it's interesting to me that in the process of this, she's got a skeptical Bela, who all Bela wants to do is fight for her. Like, that's her, yeah. That's the only thing she's down with doing. And you've still developed a plan that alienated her.
Yeah, if Bela and Hugh are, you know, looking at you going, you sure about this? You've lost the moral center a bit. Because they're the honorable people that we've, the intelligent, capable people and the honorable people that we have in the show. That's what they represent. That's what we've seen of them so far. And they're looking at this going, just to clarify, because you were non-specific on the details, are you asking us to carpet bomb the two of the largest cities in the realm? Because that kind of just seemed what you implied. I really want you to be specific on that. And she isn't. And I'm left to wonder, did Rhaenyra just kind of casually suggest that you do whatever necessary to get Old Town and Lannisport to submit? Does she want you to burn these things the way that everybody's now criticizing Aemon Sharpoint? I don't think she is, but I worry to what degree the two of them just kind of went, you just left that remarkably vague in terms of what you just described just what for us to do.
Yeah, but what's confusing to me about this is, like, does she know? Because the armies have left Lannisport.
Yeah. And there's what this is what matters.
I think she knows the army has left Lannisport. That one left a while ago. Like, I mean, that word got that word got around about that one. The old town piece is a little bit more confusing because even the Greens are having trouble getting word out of Old Town about what's actually going on. But she says, I want you to burn their strongholds and their armies. Well, the armies aren't in those cities anymore. So what is she suggesting? Is she suggesting go to the cities to burn the armies because it's war and I want you to defeat the armies? Or is she suggesting, I know the armies are gone. Go burn the city while there's nobody there to do anything about it. And if she's thinking that, why did she say burn their armies and their strongholds? So all of it is kind of confused and like to the point that it feels like it's bad writing because it's not even – you would think that she would even if she doesn't have perfect information, even if she's an unreliable narrator here about what the battle strategy is and what's going on in the world, she would at least present something relatively coherent to these people here, wouldn't she?
And it isn't. It's not coherent to us either. It's not made any more coherent by the scene that she has with Masari in a minute of where it seems like the show just emotionally wants us to be convinced that, now it's going to be a true war. Now it's going to be total war. Innocents are going to die. Rhaenyra is willing to bloody her hands. Oh, my God. What does this mean? What can it be? And I get that they want us to emotionally feel that. But the actual mechanics of it border on nonsensical to me. And it seems like they're not meant to be as vague as they're presented to be. It's meant to be that there's some aspect of a war strategy here, but I've got no concept of it based on what they're giving us within the episode.
Right, because if she's saying they're gathering these big armies in these big cities, they're going to march on me, go kill them by burning the city, which would also kill some innocents. But I need to. That could, but it makes no sense that she doesn't know that the Lannister army has left Lannisport. They've been gone this entire season and have been just sitting away from Lannisport, right? Because they're in, where are they at? The Golden Tooth. Yeah, they've been sitting at the Golden Tooth. So it doesn't make any sense to me she wouldn't know that. So I'm quite confused from this scene, and I wish they'd been a tad more specific. Not that she doesn't – and by the way, I don't care which it is, but there's great character development if she's saying burn the city while the army's gone because that shows her further sending into this war and into maybe potential madness. But like – I also don't mind if it's, well, I'm actually targeting the armies because that would be in line with kind of how she's been up till now. So it could be a inflection point in her character, could not. But either way, make it clear.
Yeah, and I don't even think she's necessarily proposing that they, like, you know, do a Dany on King's Landing. This is more that send the dragons and make them submit because, you know, do enough damage and they'll eventually bow the knee to you. And that's fine if that's just what she's proposing too, but say that. Give us a little more clarity on that because the conversation, the characters' reactions to it is unnecessarily vague for us as an audience to truly conceptualize what this character is now willing to do or not. And that's not something that should be this degree of vague to us when this is the character talking to other people. If they're not talking, if they're just acting, we're left to ponder that. But this is her talking to her soldiers about her battle plan. That should be relatively clear, unless you're trying to say the dangers of it not being clear, which I don't think that's the direction they're going in.
And then we have a scene. This is an example of where I would have written Rhaenyra differently, where Ulf goes, because basically Adam brings up, hey, what are we going to do about Vhagar? And she's like, well, Vhagar can fight everybody. And Ulf goes, I'll take him on myself. Silverwing's a goer. She is. We're afraid of nothing. And he says this when he's like taking a drink and smirking. And we've seen Ulf, right? We've seen other Ulf scenes. The move here is to kick back in your chair and go, oh, is that right? Oh, goer, is she? When did you figure that out? When you were hanging on by one arm and she was joyriding you around King's Landing? When have you learned how much all this about Silverwing? Fire back. Joke back. Say it with a smile. He would have responded so much better because this is how this guy communicates. I honestly don't think that he means this as overt disrespect. It might be like passive, but this is how he talks to his friends. We've seen it. So she's just not able to read this different culture than her own and respond to it.
She's not able to respond to bro culture. This man wants to bro it out right now. He wants to have a drunken revelry kind of conversation. He wants to celebrate. He's happy. And this is how he responds when he's happy, by telling jokes, by being overconfident, by pissing in everybody's ear a little bit. This is Ulf. He doesn't necessarily mean anything negative by this. He just wants people to vibe. And this is not that room. And if someone had just let down their hair even to the slightest of degree, there would have been an earning of loyalty that we otherwise previously haven't had.
See, you gendered it a little bit by calling it bro culture. I think it's a different class, right? Because I feel like Massaria would have done well with this.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that Rhaenyra, knowing that she is a station above Ulf, is contributing to her inability to talk to him because she's still treating him like lower class than herself. Mm-hmm. We've seen her engage in witty repertoire with people before. She's able to fire back and forth. She's not doing it with this guy because she's carrying herself like someone above his station. So it's her own prejudices that are hurting her here and her inability to work with Ulf. I'm not saying I like Ulf. Ulf is a pain in the ass. He eats something like 32 quails in this scene. He's drinking. He sucks. But like, look, you wanted other writers. He's another writer. You gotta work with him. There's a path to do it here that isn't that difficult.
I feel like he has a good rejoinder at one point too, of where, you know, when he's demanding little birds, who is it that says a knight will comport himself with grace at the queen's table? Someone yells that at him.
Is Jace?
Probably is Jace.
No, Rhaenyra says that. Rhaenyra says that.
Oh, okay. That makes it even more meaningful, because his response is then, well, you best make me a knight then. And that's got a certain degree of edge to it too, of where, you know, promises of the wind, and that's what you're offering me right now. So maybe make good on a couple of those if you want me to fully, you know, abide by the rules you wish to impose upon me. And don't get that.
I'm too busy.
Too busy.
Too busy ordering more quail. Too busy ordering more quail. You're eating me at a house and home here. There's a million things she could have said that would work better. Instead, she bristled, and Jace says, you forget yourself, friend. Like, how dare you speak to her that way? It's all off-center. It's all not looking at the ultimate goal here.
And it didn't have to be.
Then we get Maester Gerardis talking to Rhaenyra and says, hey, look, we got a note from the Castellan of Harrenhal, Sir Simon Strong. He fears treachery. She goes, I won't allow it. And then she grabs her favorite new hire of the group, Adam, which I can see why. I would probably grab Adam here, too. And he goes, all right, come with me. First off, he seems like a more comfortable rider than the other two at this stage, although it's marginal. They're all new. And also he seems more capable of taking an order right now.
But both him and his dragon, for that matter.
Yeah. So then we cut to Daemon, who's talking to Alice, because Alice just shows up on his... I love that Alice has such free roam of Harrenhal. They're like, yeah, come stay at Harrenhal. We're a fantastic bed and breakfast. Spacious. It's spacious. Very historic. We've got some great lamb. We've got a really cool B&B owner here who's going to hang out with you and sit in the drawing room at night, hang out. But every once in a while, our friendly neighborhood witch is just going to show up in your bedroom at night. Like, it's just going to happen.
It's verging on that. I'm wondering to what degree she's actually apparating between rooms, because she doesn't open doors. She just appears. Like, you're sitting, and suddenly she just no-clipped through the wall, and there she's there right in front of you. And she's done this in several scenes, and it adds to this element of, you know, separation from reality, this magical realism that is just steeped in Harrenhal, that you're never fully certain what is real and what isn't. And that equally applies to whether Alice Rivers is actually there before you or not.
The way she operates conveys an intimacy to me that tells me that, like, She is going to do whatever she needs to do to get a Daemon where she wants to get him. If that means that they, you know, gotta kill somebody who deserves killing or something, she's got to do something fairly brutal, she'll probably do it. If she had to sleep with Daemon, she probably would do it. If she had to, you know, move money around in some sort of sketchy, weird way, if she had to sleep in bed next to him, all of this stuff is on the table. Because she doesn't seem to have clear boundaries in how she's operating with him. She's in his mind. She's in his bedroom. She comes to him all hours of the day and night. She speaks to him about highly personal things. She comes in and out of that. And now she's going to go take him to see what the future can be. You called this earlier the future, and I don't think it quite is. We'll get to that in a second. But she had this intimacy about her that I find really interesting and abrupt, and not – it certainly sets her apart from the other characters on the show, who all seem to have fairly clear lines of appropriateness.
I agree. She acts as someone who has known you forever, and that carries through in terms of how she's carried herself when it comes to Damon. And it seems like it's forced her through both the vision she's shown him, but also just her bearing has forced her way past a lot of his barriers.
So she mentions, you know, the old magic, to him about it.
What is the antlered thing that is, you know, clip-clopping in the background of this scene? What Midsummer Night's Dream have we now stumbled into? That's not explained to any degree.
I'm not sure it's real, because Damon sees it and then blinks and it's gone. So I'm not 100% sure it's real. But it feels like some sort of old magic thing, but that doesn't necessarily connect to any part of the lore that I know.
Nor I.
So then she starts talking about how all the progress he's made. This is like you've gone to a therapist for about a year, and they start summarizing. Yep. You know, when you came to me, you were angry and you were jacked up on Red Bull when you got here, and now you're just calm. You're not fidgeting. He doesn't scoff at this, which she calls out, and he goes, "Yeah, no, I'm not inclined to." He's with her now. He's going to follow her. So she gives him the vision, and he has the vision. Now, I mentioned that I didn't necessarily think this was the future. You rolled your eyes. So you tell me why you think this is the future, or why the distinction doesn't matter.
We know that some of the events that are seen literally occur. We know that several of them literally exist. So it is unquestionably things that will happen in terms of at least a lot of what is shown. Dany and the Three Dragons will be born. The Night's King will rise and the dead will walk. Blood Raven will be a thing and will be the last Green Seer. Rhaenyra will sit the throne. These are things that, you know, are being depicted.
Maybe.
Rhaenyra's a maybe, but it's certainly something he's now convinced of at the end of the scene. But several of those things we saw in Game of Thrones, those are written history, written future now, history for you and I. So we know that those are going to occur, and those are threaded into the visions that he has. So it gives us, as an audience, a belief that what he sees is real, because we know certain of the things that he sees are unquestionably real. What he makes of those, whether everything that's depicted is accurate, that is left ambiguous. But the fact that known events are occurring within this vision is a relevant point to say that this is future beyond just simply vision.
Some of the language you use there confused me. You go, this is written history, but it's not history.
I didn't mean history. I meant history for us in terms of things you and I have already seen on television when it comes to the television Game of Thrones.
I took this as a vision of what could be and needed to happen to fight the others. This is what the powers in this world are driving toward. But it's not necessarily going to happen if people don't play their part, if people don't do what they're meant to do. And that's a distinction between your fated path and a rigid fate that there no free will exist, that you have to accomplish. I thought the purpose of this vision was saying, this is the goal. This is what we're driving toward. This is what has to happen. Your part in it is important. It's not, you're not the primary actor. You're not the hero of this story, but we need you to be a part of making this a reality. So yes, it does happen in this world, but at this point in the story, it's not necessarily going to happen if people don't do their part.
And it is interesting because I think that there's a conflict within the story on even this point of where I think Alice Rivers has your point of view about this is a future that can be. And this is a future that in many ways needs to be, and you need to play a part in that. And part of what I've been showing you is that you need to accept that the story is bigger than you, and that there are things that are more important than you, and you need to act in furtherance of those more important things. But in the course of this, we get Helena also inserting herself into the vision in a way that I would love to know if Alice Rivers was knowing this was going to happen. I prefer to think that she didn't, that Helena would, you know, step into this story that she's, you know, yeah, depicting to Damon. And Helena is, we've used the word nihilistic before, but she's determinist in my mind when it comes to this, of where she sees this is written. She sees this is going to happen because she is the dreamer. She lives in these dreams. Her perspective is this is already in stone. There's nothing you can do to avoid it. And so this is the narrative you just need to accept and step into, because it's going to happen whether you wish it to or not. But I don't think Alice Rivers is. And part of the reason I say this, is because of the conversation she has with Eamon here in a minute. So I'm bleeding into a bit of future knowledge too.
Okay. All right. So like the quick. So I was wondering where did you get that from? Because she says you know what you must do, and I was wondering if you were thinking the word must there is what was driving this deterministic philosophy from her. But you're also talking about from Damon or Eamon later when she's basically like, "Gal, this is going to happen. Future's written."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find it a fun degree of tension because I would love if Helena and Alice had a conversation. I'm assuming they never will. But I think the two of them are operating within some of the same field and some of the same magic, different magic, but they have different ways, they have similar ways of expressing themselves. But I feel like the two of them would fundamentally disagree about what the point of it all is and what degree it can actually affect an individual. Because I don't think Helena believes in free will. I think she sees this as all written and all just an overgrown tragedy that she almost is cursed to know what's going to occur. And I don't think Alice Rivers sees it that way at all.
So you interpreted this the way that I do, that Helena was really there in that vision, that she had inserted herself in the vision in some way, which would bring her level of magic, so the realm that she operates in this world, more in line with Blood Raven, where there's the interplay with the old magic.
100%. Yes,
because it's clearly an old magic-driven vision Alice Rivers wrapped in the old magic. She's using the weirwood for the vision, but Helena does show up in it. I agree with you. I think that Helena is a part of it, and I think that what we're learning is that the dreamer, being a Targaryen dreamer, is not something that is
passive.
Right. It's something more ubiquitous in this world than just some lineage of Valyria that, you know, they have every four generations or something, and it helps you, you know, see like some parts of the future. It's something broader than that that exists writ large in the world.
Yeah, it's as if there's a magical font that people can find different ways to tap into, that there is magic and there are different means of gaining access to it. And I like the idea of Helena not just being a passive character. These aren't just visions that are inserted upon her and that she just has. But she actually is tapping into a world of magic that most of the people aren't capable of. She may not fully understand it. She certainly doesn't seem to have full control over it. But she has a bit of an active role in it that we previously didn't understand. And that could be really interesting of where they go with that going forward. And it gives us a certain degree of perspective into her that I think I previously lacked to any degree.
I think you're certainly powering her up. I think the question's out there if she's a Greenseer, right?
Or some Targaryen equivalent, sure.
Right, that's what I'm driving at here, is that maybe what we've been calling Greenseer, what we've been calling Dreamer, that they neither one of those in a silo are perfect definitions of what this magic is, and it's a little bit more far-reaching and mm-hmm. pervasive in the entire world than what we know already.
I'm with you on that.
We've got Helena talking to Damon out on the balcony of King's Landing. This conversation you were talking about, where he gives her a pitch about, come with me to Harrenhal, we'll lay waste to Damon and his army, let our enemies see that we will answer outrage with outrage. She says, what if I refuse? Will you burn me as Aegon did? He goes, that's a lie. She goes, I saw it. You burned him and you let him fall. So there you go. I think we've got now, but something that I'm willing to say is canon, that he did do that on purpose, and he was burning Aegon to try to kill him. Aemon says, well, what you say is treason, and she explains that he'll be king again. He's yet to see victory. He sits on a wooden throne, and you were swallowed up in the God's Eye, and you were never seen again. The God's Eye is a body of water.
Mm-hmm. Near Harrenhal.
And he goes, I could have you killed. She says, it wouldn't change a thing. You want to talk about that scene?
And this is, again, where I view her view of prophecy, whatever else, is deterministic. I don't think that she'd think there's an element of free will. I think from her perspective, it's just this is the story. You can step in it and go with the flow, or you can resist it. The results can ultimately be the same. I think that she has a fundamental different understanding of what the point of these visions and prophecy, whatever else, is than it comes to someone like Alice or other people that, you know, view prophecy in the course of this tale. She sees that, you know, it's part of the reason that she's so resistant to other people imposing any kind of will upon her, because she sees the wife as a collection of roles. She sees this as a story that she's almost a part of and just watching. And so it almost confuses her to see people like Aemon that are constantly resisting against her. They're constantly trying to change their fate. They're constantly trying to change the role that they play in the narrative and the story and the overall expression of life, because she fundamentally doesn't understand reality in the same kind of way. So it's an interesting counterpoint to the conversation with Daemon, because I think Alice is trying to guide Daemon, while at the same time Helena, who is stepping into the same conversation, is having this conversation with Aemon about, I've seen the future, it's going to occur, what are you even trying to do here?
Yeah, we agree. I think that Helena, and she did last season too,
yeah,
she views what she sees as absolute truths about the future.
Gospel.
And I'm not sure that Alice has seen those things the same way. I'm not sure they're necessarily seeing the same thing, but there is a difference in their concept of free will and that effect that free will have on future events between the two characters. I'm not sure either one is right, or we're supposed to think either one is right, but I do think we're supposed to note the difference.
I like that difference. I like two people operating seemingly within the same field, and I say that in a broad term. I think they're very different. There's differences between how the two of their magics express, but they're doing kind of the same thing when it comes to visions and guiding other people or talking to other people. And I like that they have a fundamental different understanding of their own magic and their own point of it all. That's a fun degree of tension, and we see that expressed so differently in the two characters of where Alice is a very active character. She's trying to guide other people. She's trying to change events. She's trying to change the story, or at least set people on the path to better stories for themselves, for others, for the realm, whatever else. At least that's what we've seen of her so far. There could be a dark edge yet. Don't know. We'll see. Helena comes across as much more passive because, from her perspective, it doesn't matter. This is in many ways more of a curse that she is constantly burdened with these visions of the future, because it just paints where she's exactly everything is going to be within a few days. And from her perspective, everything is terrible, because at least for her, it kind of has been. The show has done that in a way that I did not pick up at all from the book, because these characters are much better realized on the screen. They have more time for it. And I'm 100% here with it. I think that is a fun degree of difference of opinion about the magic that they're wielding and how that affects their individual philosophies upon the world.
I think it would make for a fun sequence and a fun storyline if Helena were to have one of her prophecies not come true.
Yeah.
Like she's so sure that they're going to come true. It'd be interesting that she had a vision and it didn't happen.
It was some of our favorite scenes of the book with Melisandre, where she was so certain in her own visions, and to see them not come to pass or come to pass in ways that she misinterpreted was just a lovely degree of more rounding that character to ultimately make her one of my favorite characters in the text.
I think that's a great thing to bring up, is that in this world we've had characters that unquestionably can interact with magic, absolutely yes. can, who have also been wrong.
Yeah.
And so I think that's very possible for Alice or Helena here. We just shot over here in hall. We see Cyrex and Sea Smoke approach. Caraxes looks up and is like, what the fuck is this? So, you know, what's interesting to me is that, like, the dragons aren't pets. I think they're partners with their,
yes.
their bonded dragon rider. But because we as humans, the best thing that we can sort of use to explain bonded non-humans is usually through pets, which everybody has at least seen or interacted with. A lot of times we compare some of the dragons' interactions to, like, cats. I think Caraxes is much more of a dog. You know how,
yeah.
like, you have a dog, and then, like, another dog gets close, and that dog arches its back, the fur goes up, you know, along the spine, and starts barking. That's what I took Caraxes to be doing here. It was just barking at another dog. Like, get out of here. I didn't know you were coming. I'm uncomfortable.
I was going to ask you about that. Cause we know him before, you know, the complicated life that you lived. You had also had 7 years spent as an animal handler in a circus. And so you've got a lot of experience in terms of your, assessing how animals react to things, particularly Caraxes. So that's an interesting read. And I'm kind of there with you about it didn't feel necessarily like, intimately hostile. It didn't feel friendly. It felt very much of a territorial kind of thing in terms of that response about, hey, this is my camp. This is my guy. What are you doing here? You didn't announce yourself previously. I'm demanding advance notice before anyone enters my home again.
If you have a dog and it's asleep or not paying attention, and then it gets caught with the smell or sight of another dog it wasn't anticipating, it will stand up and just give a couple what the fuck barks. Like, yeah. Those barks are not because of any, it doesn't necessarily want to rip the throat out of the other dog. It's not as necessarily happy the other dog's there. It's just startled. It's just, this is just a signal that I'm startled. So that's what I got from Caraxes there. People see the dragons and run. They want no fucking part of that. I like that theme throughout is that anytime the dragons are somewhere that people aren't expecting them to be, most of the time those people get scared unless it's King's Landing.
Yes.
Simon Strong comes out, talks to Rhaenyra, and says, hey, look, I had reason to fear. Come on in. Come check this out.
And I love Simon Strong. I love that he was the one that sent the letter to Rhaenyra. He's a greatly realized character, but also just a good guy in terms of voicing the concerns to her about, you need to come quick. This is spiraling out of control. But things have come around a bit.
Yeah, so a lot of the dedicated Westeros community online does tend to go to Dragon Con. Like, it's one of the big cons that a lot of that community will go to now. And there is a lot of discussion about who, how many, how extensively people will be cosplayed as Simon Strong because of the intense love of that character. People have a lot of problems with season two. I've heard very few problems with Simon Strong.
No, everybody loves Simon Strong in a way that no one saw coming. Like, there's certain shows of where, you can build in presumptions about who's going to be the character everybody's excited about. No, Simon Strong was on no one's bingo card, but man, has he won the game.
That's the thing. Like, when we talk about these things, we're often not nuanced enough, because I think it's very easy now to say, oh, well, when they get away from the original story, then they get screwed up, right? When they create Lohar, They get sideways because Lohar wasn't very good. They have created a lot of Simon Strong out of whole cloth here, and it's fantastic. In the same way, like with Game of Thrones, it was like, oh, well, when they got past the books, it was terrible. That's not a nuanced enough argument. One of the best episodes of the entire series was The Winds of Winter, the finale of season six, and that was whole cloth. That was not written in the book. New events, and it was fantastic. Right? So we just don't do enough of that nuanced stuff when we're trying to figure out themes and patterns. But man, is Simon Strong good, right? And he's a testament to the idea that, like, they can flesh out or create new characters well. They're just not doing it. They're not batting 100%, right?
Yeah.
Rhaenyra goes inside. You see the soldiers
army.
Oh shit. Like, it's definitely like, oh man, I didn't expect.
Mom's here.
I didn't expect the VP to be here today. Damn, I wish I'd tucked my shirt in. And they all kind of turn around, and Daemon approaches. And you see the people parting, the army parting for him as he gets there. And right away, Rhaenyra is charming. I got to say, because he says, I wasn't expecting you. And she says, that seems rather a lapse in foresight. Mm-hmm. And it's like, could you have used that same wit and charm for 5 seconds with Ulf? Because you got it. You're really good at it. You're clearly mad at Daemon, but you're still able to fire off those charming lines.
I love this so much. I was hoping for a reunion between the two of them. It was one of the things I bet on. And among so many of the things I had wrong, I at least got this one right. The two of them had a reunion this season. And
I'd already divorced them.
I know you had. It's great. I love the two of them immediately start falling into their relationship again, almost in spite of themselves, particularly in spite of Rhaenyra right now, because she doesn't fully understand where Daemon's coming from. But, yeah, that opening line of, it has an edge to it, but it's also just playful. They're having a bit of banter. These are two characters that know each other intimately in many ways that are interacting in that kind of way. A lot of ways. And it works wonderfully. This is, again, one of my favorite scenes of the episode, just to see the two of them interact and talk with each other. Along with the fact that among the various plot lines that actually complete this season, This is the main one we get an actual climax to. This is the one we actually get a resolution to, of the tortured relationship, them breaking apart, and then, like, episode one or episode two, and then coming back together in some shape or form now by here in episode eight. This is a complete story. Not overall complete to their relationship and the narrative, but the one they wanted to tell this season is actually completed this season. At least one is able to see both the beginning and an end.
Yeah, I'll grant you that. I don't know that they're... You said back together in some shape or form. I'm glad you included some shape or form.
Some shape or form. They do not conceptualize in this episode what they are now to each other, other than they are able to work together and there is some suggestion of a relationship going forward. I'm not even saying that's romantic. I'm not saying it is going to be husband and wife. I don't know that yet. But he is willing to respect her in a way that he hasn't before. He is willing to acknowledge her as queen, and they are working together. That is a relationship. What its exact parameters are, I would think would be unfair to say at this point, other than it feels warm between the two of them more than just coworkers.
Did Rhaenyra put one finger up in the sky and ask the crowd to acknowledge her? I wonder if she did that. One thing she did do is she really rolled the dice, because he said, "They are sworn to me and not a moment too soon," talking about the army. She stands back and speaks very loudly and says, "And to whom are you sworn?" There's a real roll of the dice here. And he moves forward and says, "Let's talk a little privately." He speaks High Valyrian and says, "The world is not what we thought it was. The war is just beginning. Winter is coming with darkness and doom." So he speaks House Stark house
speaks
words.
The prophecy. Here.
"Winter is coming with darkness and doom." She says, "You sound like my father." And he says, "I saw it. I saw that we cannot withstand it. And yet somehow we must." And that helps me understand what Alice was attempting to convey. Because I think Daemon was picking up what she was putting down. And she was saying, this is what must happen. So he uses the word must, not will. He said he could have said, I feel like if Helena's saying this, she would have said, "I saw what we should not be able to withstand, but we will." But he says, "I saw what we cannot withstand, and yet somehow we must." So I have to play my part to ensure that we do this thing that I saw.
There's a choice there.
Yeah, we still got free will, right? It's important. Our choices matter. What we do is important. We must do them, but it is important. Daemon says the realm's only hope, back to common tongue now, is a leader
speaking
who can
to
unite.
The crowd.
"And my brother chose you." Little music plays, inspiring music. He gets down on one knee. She looks down pensive. He says, "You are the true queen, Rhaenyra. First of her name, protector of the realm. I am meant to serve you and all of those with me until death or the end of our story."
It's great. It's powerful. It's a culmination so much for Rhaenyra, the idea that people would actually bow to her, accept her, that men in particular, soldiers, warriors, generals, would actually accept her. It's something that she's struggled with all season and at times alienated herself from them. She feels like she can never actually earn their true loyalty. And here she has it from the most headstrong, self-driven, egotistical person that she has in her life in the form of Daemon. And the world bows with him. It is a victory for her beyond any that she could ever have expected. And it's coming from a place of what feels like true loyalty in a way that she never could have hoped that she'd have from Daemon. And he says this publicly. This is to the room. The room is now kneeling with him and acknowledging her lordship. He started with privately. He started with a very private conversation to her. Now he's announcing it to the world because it's meant to be a common cause that's bringing together under her banner. And I like that she then now offers a bit of intimacy to him. She speaks back to him in High Valyrian, a private conversation between the two of them. Did you write down exactly what she said? Because I don't have it.
"Leave me again at your peril. I could not. I have tried."
I like that that's playful. I like that it's meant between the two of them. This is where I think relationship has some hope that they actually could be together in a way, a bit of what they once were, because she seems to be opening the door to it once again. He met her on those terms, but he announced the loyalty that she in some ways needs for them to have that kind of relationship, and she responds in kind that there could be some hope for them going forward.
She needs to be careful with that, because she's already got another girlfriend, and that other girlfriend is pretty important to her military strategy. So you can't just go back to Masaria and be like, "We got to stop this. I'm back with this guy who you really don't like.
I've got some thoughts written out here that I want to talk about to you when we get to the scene of Allison. Because I feel like Rhaenyra has five main relationships with characters over the course of the show, and her and Daemon are definitely one of them. And I'm curious of your thoughts to what degree each of them works for you, and to what degree that they have tensions with each other.
Five main relationships this season?
This season, and in general when it comes to other characters. Like, I'll lay them out here so we can talk about them later as well. But Rhaenyra and Daemon, unquestionably. Rhaenyra and Jace. Yep. Rhaenyra and Massaria. Rhaenyra and I put these two at the same label because I feel like they overlap to a certain degree, but Rhaenys and Corlys, the season
and Allison. Okay.
And Rhaenyra and Allison. I feel like those are the relationships that the show has gone most into, and some of them work better for others in my mind, and I like that several of them also have tensions with each other.
I'm going to give her a six. She needs to have one with Ulf.
With Ulf? Yeah, Ulf, not no hope whatsoever at this point. Maybe Hugh. Hugh feels like he's got somebody that would work with Rhaenyra. Ulf, got to meet him halfway.
She can. Yeah, she doesn't have to like it, but she's got to do it. So Daemon cheers. For every one of us who falls, 100 of them, there will be no mercy. We fight for our queen. They're back. They're behind them. They're behind both Daemon and Rhaenyra. They're cheering. And then we get
army.
Seasoning talking to Alan. And this is if the scene with Gawain and Cole was not scene of the episode, then this is. I would probably say this is my favorite scene of the episode. And that second, you had described on the reaction podcast that the Gawain and Cole was your favorite scene of the episode. Where do you rank this one in comparison to that?
This is a close second for me. I would switch the two, but I think they're very close to each other in terms of their effect. And what drives this one, I like the philosophy that we got to see and the character development and seeing where the arcs go with whatever else. There's an aspect of that scene, but what this makes the scene most powerful, along with just the quality writing, is just the acting. The actor that plays, is this Alan or Adam? This is Alan.
Alan. Right?
Alan, thank you. The actor who plays Alan acts the pants off this scene in terms of just the almost uncontrollable anger and tension, resentment that is just bubbling out of him as he's delivering these lines. And that just sells it so beautifully.
So, you're right. He does.
Close second for me.
You're right. He does. And what's interesting is that oftentimes when people are really angry at their parents specifically, mm-hmm. they can struggle to see their own piece of that or their own faults. It's why you get this sort of tropey line, oh, you blame everything on your parents, right? Because that's a very common thing, is to get so frustrated and blind with anger at your parents for whatever that you don't see areas where you could have potentially improved or done something differently or better. And I think that Alan falls into that slightly here because Corlys starts by saying, hey, look, you can't lead if you don't inspire. You're curt, silent, and the men find you distant. Alan never addresses the fact that he's not as effective in his position as he could be and that Corlys is giving him some advice on that front. And instead, tight-lipped, until Corlys goes, look, I'm just trying to help you out here. He goes, oh, help me, are you? Like, and then he goes into, well, here's how much you've helped me.
Oh, yeah.
So he's got this resentment, well-founded resentment.
Mm-hmm. It comes from fearing.
Right. But it's stopping him from being as effective as he can be in his current position, which is just so completely human when dealing with a frustration with a parent.
Yeah.
And he gives
so real.
He gives probably the best monologue of the season, maybe the series. When he says, do you know what it was like for us to grow up fatherless, to be sneered upon as bastards, never sure of the bread to feed us? Do you know what hunger does to a boy, what grief does, or shame? Corlys says you are dismissed in like hurrying tones, like, please don't do this.
Shut up, please.
I sold fish in the market from cold dawn until sunset, putting by coppers to starve off the winter, and I watched the man who sired me walk past with his son and heir with a fur around his shoulders, choosing sweetmeats to eat after supper by the fire. Now that boy is dead and his sister before him, and the heir took his place. And now you remember I live, and you wish to suddenly to scatter the crumbs of your favor. I am an honorable man, and I will serve you because I must, but if it's all the same, I will decline any offers of help. Probably the best monologue of the series. It's extremely good. And almost as good as the monologue, not as good as the monologue, but almost as good, is the Seasonic's reaction to it all as it's going on.
It's a beautifully done scene. It's a powerful scene. It's a scene you and I have been hoping for, but, you know, we keep on saying, oh, man, if we only can get that conversation that he actually will talk with one of his bastards. He actually have that kind of narrative with him. And we haven't gotten it until now. And it, as expected, it is a hell of an effective, well-delivered, well-written, powerful moment.
Yeah. Then we cut to Missaria and Rhaenyra. And Missaria is basically congratulating her, like, hey, you did it. And she goes, she kind of grumbles a little bit and says, yeah, well, to claim this victory, I must strike. And in striking, I doom thousands to their death. And it seems like Missaria doesn't really like self-pity. She reacts very negatively whenever Rhaenyra's like, yeah, well, yeah, but, like, you know, when you're trying to give somebody a compliment.
Yeah.
And you say, hey, you did so good. Yeah, well, I didn't do as good as I could have. And you're, okay, well, you're miserable. Like, you know, when you're just trying to give, like, you're trying to say there is something here to be pleased about. And it seems like Rhaenyra's not able to do that. She goes on. Rhaenyra says, you know, I do not believe my father would have wished this. And Missaria says, he left you with no choice. You know, you must not let the realm fall to those who care for power more than peace. You must prevail. And she says, and who pays the price? And they look at dragons flying overhead as she says that line, which I thought was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Who pays the price? And then look at the dragons, because that's how they'll be paying that price.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting scene of where we've talked about Missaria's having more concerns with the common folk and trying to draw Rhaenyra in that direction. But this demonstrates that she has a broader perspective, is that she's that. For the common folk to be at peace and be happy, the realm needs to be at peace. And you need to do what's necessary to do that. It's this, you know, your actions are going to lead to a lot of people dying. That includes common folk. That's going to be part of this. But if you're not willing to do that, there can be no future for everything. But Rhaenyra's, because she is her father's daughter, because she's still concerned with furthering his philosophy and his objectives upon, you know, the future and how the realm should be governed, she's still looking at this going, but it's going to be the average person that suffers. It's like, I know net good, unquestionably, utilitarian, John Stuart Mill, I buy that. But it is still going to be me killing an average person here to make this happen. And I don't know if I'm ever going to be okay with that.
So, I was going to give you shit for saying John Stuart Mill, but fair.
Mm.
You do know where the term comes from, so, you know, some, brag about it a little bit. That's okay. Puff those peacock feathers a little bit.
I actually don't know anything. What are you talking about?
Speaking of bragging, do you know who the Kingsguard is who comes into Rhaenyra's room?
That comes in the room right now?
Yeah.
Marbrant?
Yeah, it's only what she got.
It makes it easy.
It's like her second Lord Commander, and it's the only one she's got right now.
So
he comes in. She she lets him in, but she seems uncomfortable. Somebody's coming in, not like uncomfortable, like a propriety thing. Although that may be a percentage of it. More like the last time this happened, it was Eric and Eric fucking killing each other, and I almost died. Like I don't really like. She's got, you know, some bad memories of people busting in her room. So in comes Marbrand and says, you have a visitor. And so she goes and she has a conversation with Alicent. Now, I dislike this scene for multiple reasons.
Yes.
The first is that there seems to be an over-reliance on the relationship of Rhaenyra and Alicent, and also the representation of Rhaenyra as Black, Team Black, and Alicent as a representation of Team Green to this overall narrative. Both of those dynamics are not true, not true to the fundamental tension and conflict in my mind, that it's not a story of Rhaenyra versus Alicent. I don't view that that's what this war is, and I don't, in my mind, that's not the story. And also, I don't buy necessarily that Alicent is a representation of the Green, and I'm also not 100% sure that Rhaenyra is 100% representation of Team Black. Like, I think these things are much more complicated, and they're trying to condense it to a movie poster where both of their foreheads can be looking at each other and like, okay, that's the fight, right? And it's never that's never landed with me. I also don't like, the second piece of this I don't really like is how it takes you out of the realism of this world. If it was possible for someone from Team Green to get into Dragonstone Castle by sailing a ship at 3 a.m. with one guard, then why on earth hasn't Aemon or Aegon sent a stream of said people at 3 a.m. every single night to get into Dragonstone? If they are that weakly fortified, then why hasn't there been more holes poked at their defenses? There would be. There obviously would be. Alicent would never be able to get this close. I think been rejected at the docks. I think the ship would have been sank before she got to the docks. I mean, they would have so much security around Dragonstone right now with all of the escalating tensions in this war and the attacks on the persons of the monarchy on both sides that this would never have occurred. It's 80% as silly as Rhaenyra going to King's Landing. That is like the all-time stupid move. But this is a derivative of that. And the final thing I'll say on this is that it's repetitive. We've already had this conversation. We don't need it again. So even if you are going to have their two foreheads on the movie poster going against each other, even if you are going to say, oh, to hell with realism, we'll just have them sort of break through the lines of defenses and have a conversation. If you're going to do that, you've already fucking done it. So there's no reason to do it again. Spencer, what say you?
I largely very much agree with you. I mean, it comes down to, may I quote the lead writer of the episode for you? Because I feel like it summarizes some of the problems you and I have. There's so much in play. This is a Sarah Hess. There are so much in play. There are armies. There are dragons. There's castle strongholds and political maneuvering. But at the end of the day, it comes down to these two women trying to figure it out. And that was her kind of impression in my mind, not only the episode, but the overall story. And it summarizes that I just have a fundamental different valuing of their relationship and its role in the story and how what degree these two characters should be driving the plot individually than apparently the writers of this show do. Because I think it's a problem just like you do. I mean, I'm reminded, when we were watching the advertising going into this season, I think you and I agreed that the dumbest bit of advertising we saw was a bit of like, you know, bringing in the paparazzi, whatever else. And it's just the actress that plays Rhaenyra and the actress that plays Alicent. Just like circle each other and then like just staring at each other and doing chest punch, whatever else. And you and I just both looked at it and said, well, that was dumb as shit. I hope that doesn't symbolize anything going forward.
They also did the stage chess match between the two, where they were both on a chess board, like the two actors.
I forgot about that one. Yeah. The show wants to make everything about their relationship, and I'm not here for it. It's made for the most ham-handed scenes of the season. It was still a well-delivered season. It was written well enough, but it factors in my mind part of the reason that they're whitewashing the shit out of both of these characters and minimizing others and not progressing the overall narrative and ultimately altering a lot of the themes because they want to make their relationship the driving force of everything, the lodestone that they return to at every given moment. And I think that's causing more problems than it's adding net benefit. It leaves me wondering what story this show is trying to tell, if this is what you feel is the most important thing. And it ended on the most laughable moment for me in this scene of where at the end of this scene of when you're negotiating terms and Alicent's, you know, trying to avoid a war and they're talking about why characters did what characters did, Alicent trying to defend herself, Rhaenyra calling her out on the shit, Alicent eventually saying that she's going to offer King's Landing and turn everything over, and Rhaenyra saying, you know, you've got to give me Aegon because of course you have to give me Aegon because it's the only way we'll ever actually be at peace. Alicent after, what? You timed it. It's like a 2-minute pause as she ponders this over.
I got that in the recap. I'll talk about it. Yeah, I did pause it. I did time it again, yeah.
Okay. And she ends it with, you know, yeah, I'll do whatever else. But she ends it with, come with me. As if these two are like spurned lovers, which I think the show thinks that they are. And it's like, you know, we can run away together. Everything will be fine. And I'm rolling my eyes at this just as much as Rhaenyra was rolling her eyes when Cole made her the same offer back in season one. Because it's just that dumb. But I think the show wants us to look at it and said, oh my god, if only she'd run away with her right then, everything would have been great. And I'm like, where are you coming from on this? No! But I'm interfering with your recap now. Please go through it. It deserves to be recapped in greater detail. But I'm there with you about, of the five relationships I summarized, Rhaenyra Allison has been, in my mind, the least natural and the most forced for the show. Not that it exists. I felt like their relationship in season one was fascinating. But God, I wish they'd stayed with that. Seen them two at odds, seen the two of them then therefore be able to progress. Because the fact you have the two of them continually orbiting and repeating these same scenes together, it feels like neither one's allowed character development within their own relationship. Because you've got them just in always geosynchronous orbit of each other. So I'm with you. I don't particularly like it. I don't think I dislike it quite as much as you do, but I think I'm with you that it causes more problems than I think it had benefits to the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, one of the things I liked about this, about the Dance of the Dragons, is that it felt like there were some parallels to World War One for me. In the sense you ask anybody, what was the reason for World War One? Well, if you ask people now, they're not going to know. But if you ask, like, people normally, who might know this type of thing, what the reasons for World War One are, you're going to hear, well, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. That's what you hear, right? That war was inevitable because of a massive distrust of alliances between European powers. There was Imperial Germany was going to insert itself into the war. There was a number of things that were moving toward war despite that one event. And that's what this always felt like to me, is that there was this was moving toward war, even if blood and cheese didn't happen. Even if Aegon didn't all of a sudden decide, yeah, I'm actually okay with this. I'll be the leader. Even if there wasn't an attempt on Rhaenyra's life in Dragonstone by Eric Cargill. Even if you'd had Rhaenyra die early on or Aegon die early on, these two sides were moving toward war in much the same way that we were going to have some version of World War One happen in the world's history, regardless of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. The over-reliance on these two characters undercuts that inevitability of war that I found so realistic and interesting from the story. And I'm like, I probably won't go through every part. They actually speak a lot here.
It goes on a while. One of the things that added to some of my negative feelings of the scene is I was watching my watch saying there's only like 16 minutes left in this episode. What more can they still do? Instead, they give us like 16 minutes of credits after the scene is over.
I said this to my wife as we were watching it. As Rhaenyra came downstairs and saw Allison, I looked at the clock and I turned to her and I said, they don't have time. They're not doing any of it. Because I was thinking through the lens of what we had talked about in our predictions of what would happen. I said, they're not doing any of it. None of it will happen. They don't have time now.
I was hoping for the Gellert. I was hoping at least for the Gellert. I was like, okay, maybe if they, you know, all 16 minutes of their remaining time is just, they give us no credit. They just end.
But that is Ryan Condal and Sarah Hess talking, right? Yeah. And, you know, to be fair to Sarah Hess, she's right for the show. If she says that's what the show is, then that's what the show is. Yeah. But the story that the show is built on was interesting to me because it was a complex web, a complex interconnection of all of these socioeconomic and political machinations and dynamics that were coming to a head through these couple figureheads. That it was more than just, oh, Rhaenyra's upset with Aegon, Aegon's upset with Rhaenyra, therefore they're at war. No, there was a lot of ice under the surface of that iceberg, right?
And I feel like it undercuts so much of what has been Allison's narrative this whole season, is her coming to the realization that she's not in control, that this is something that she started, that she does, that she can't manage, that she can't direct, that she is to a certain degree powerlessness. And she admits that in this scene and then tries to take control again and direct the overall narrative. And that it feels contrary to even what they were going with that I liked for the character this season.
We agree. I will say that there's a couple of things that I did like about the interaction. I laughed a lot when she said, what did she say? She says, man, this is long.
It's a lot. Yeah. What? Give me a hint. Which part of it? I can find, see if I can find it.
I'll find it. Yeah, I'll find it. So she's talking to, Allison is talking to Rhaenyra, and she says, I've been alone of late. I walked outside the walls of the city and I felt a weight lifted from me. And Rhaenyra goes, how lovely for you. I don't think that Emma D'Arcy gets enough credit for being able to deliver a funny line.
Yeah.
They're not given a particularly funny character. But when given a chance, Emma can drop out a funny line. That was pretty good. And
again,
then I also...
If only she had it with Ulf. If only she offered the same kind of line with Ulf, what effect it would have had.
Right. Yes, we could have seen Emma Darcy's comedy chops. And then there's a little bit of like flaring and yelling. And she does say, come away with me, basically. And it felt like, well, so, all over again. It was like, since Elrond, what the fuck ever. She's not going to leave this war right now, Allison, because you've had a good camping trip and an overall bad time the last couple months. And they do, at one point, Rhaenyra flashes anger and says, talking about Aegon, and says, you know, what are we going to do with Aegon? And she goes, well, I can prevail upon him to bend the knee. If indeed, before that, trying to get Rhaenyra sympathetic to him and says, oh, he's broken. He lives in dark and pain and terror. He's got many faults, but he still needs his mother. And she just goes, no, still you defend him. Still you imagine you can have all you want without paying too high a price I had no choice but to pay. She says, I got to take Aegon's head. And I have to do it for all to see. You know this. However you try to deny it, you know it. And that's when we get an over 2 minute sequence of Allison
pondering,
thinking about this and waiting and thinking and waiting and thinking. And I know the people who put this show together thought that was really powerful. And then in a different context. But you are at the end of season two. We are in the last few minutes of the show. Of the entire season that we've waited 2 years for. And you give us this long of a pause. It is not brave. It is, it's devoid of context. It's devoid of the context of how your audience isn't taking your media, because I don't know of a single person who wasn't frustrated watching the scene.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you exist, right? And if you do, write in, tell us, mangumtalkspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear what you think. If somebody disagrees with me, I like to hear that. I like to hear different thoughts. But I felt like it was the wrong place for such a stretch and a scene that was allowed to breathe for so long. It was the wrong place for it in the narrative.
It even starts in a line that I felt weird as well, too, of where, Rhaenyra is calling on Allison to make a sacrifice, and she ends it with a son for a son. And I'm looking at that line going, question, didn't Daemon say that line when he killed killed Allison's grandson? Like, wasn't a price already paid?
She was saying the line back.
Yeah.
That's what's so weird about it. She knows that line from Daemon, and she was saying it back to Rhaenyra.
Saying it to Allison. And it was a weird little tell moment. I didn't even know what to make of it. It's like, we'd want to see Rhaenyra as the bad guy that she's
right,
saying
yeah,
that?
Yeah, Allison, yeah.
Rhaenyra is the bad guy that she's saying that line, that she's, ignoring what crimes her side committed back on the Greens in response to the death of her son. It's like, what do you want us to feel out of this scene? I don't even know what you're doing. And then it goes into a moment of 2 minute contemplation of where I felt like we were doing the moment of silence after the Pledge of Allegiance or something at school. It's like, okay, we're watching her going on this facial journey right now, and the actress is good. She's acting it well, sure, but this is really what we want to be doing at this moment.
Yeah, Rhaenyra says it back to Allison. It's weird because she knows Daemon had said that line. And she also has told Allison, I had nothing to do with the murder of Jaehaerys. So it was weird all the way around. It was weird to let that scene breathe that long. There are times in the visual medium where that is good. Where that's a good thing to do. This just wasn't the right moment for it in my mind. Mm-hmm. But they leave with a tentative agreement for Rhaenyra to fly into King's Landing in a couple days, and Allison will make sure that she meets no resistance, that the gates are open, and that she can fly right in. Which makes the scene toward the end of the episode weird. Did you get the sense at the end of the episode that Allison was walking back into King's Landing? Into the Red Keep? Is that why she was hooded and weird?
Yes, that she was going back in to implement her deal of where she's going to convince Helena when Helena's in charge to open the gates. Yeah.
That wasn't clear. My first watching of it, I thought she was leaving again, and I was like, what is it? You're supposed to be there. You got to be a welcoming committee here in a couple of days.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right, so Rhaenyra's not going to go with her. She's not going to go sell oranges in Essos. And yeah. then we get the sequence of the last of the episode. And here's all the things we see. We see Hugh putting the armor on. Adam, too. Old's uniform is being brushed. He looked very spiffy, but they're all uncertain. We see Rhaenyra running, We see a hooded figure walking in a hallway. Hightower armies marching. Daeron onto Sarion is flying with them. That's who that dragon was. If you look at the Hightower mm-hmm. army, and you were wondering why the Hightower army had a dragon with them, that was Daeron. That is the fourth child of Alicent and Viserys. And he has been in Old Town. He's been learning at university. And he is flying onto Sarion to war with the Hightower army. Mm-hmm. Jason at the head of the Lannister army. We hear Rhaenys and Castamere, Greybeards at the crossing. So Jace secured their crossing at the Twins. And we hear the Stark theme play. Both of those scenes got me so hyped. The Greybeards actually come first and then the Lannister army. But hearing the Stark theme back to back with the Rhaenys of Castamere is just it's a bit of a nostalgia pop, but it worked for me. Mm-hmm. Daemon walking out of Harrenhal looking at the army. We see the hooded figure was Alicent. We just established she's walking back into the Red Keep. Back to Tyland on ships with Lohar. Many, many, many ships. Allen in a rowboat. Sea Snake as well, both going to the queen that never was. Rhaenyra runs to a side of a hill, looks over, and there is Sheep Stealer, who looks just as shocked to see her as she is to see it. Sheep Stealer roars at her. Alicent walks out of the castle. We see a wagon. Aegon is in it with Larrys, so he's gotten away. We see Alicent looking out over something. Rhaenyra looking at Meraxes' skull, and we end with a shot of Alicent against the sky.
Remind me in the recap. Did you mention Otto in there?
Oh yeah, Otto. I didn't mention that. Yeah, Otto chained up somewhere.
Speaking
of being devoid of context, that's completely devoid of context. Other than the fact that we got some hints that he wasn't responding to letters, so he's chained up somewhere.
I don't know what to make of that one at all. From book knowledge or otherwise, curious where they're going with that.
Yeah, it's interesting that Rhaenyra was looking at Meraxes' skull there. Mm-hmm. We continue to get the Meraxes' imagery. I think that we kind of thought that was there for where Rhaenys' character was going, knowing some of potential future events. I'm not quite sure they're done with the tie-in to what happened to Meraxes. I'll leave you with that. And then we also had Aegon slipping away with Larrys. Important. Because one of the conditions of Rhaenyra agreeing to work with Alicent was that when she got into King's Landing, she would take Aegon's head. Aegon no longer in King's Landing. I want to say one positive thing about the episode. I cannot tell you enough how much I appreciated how Sheep Stealer looked. That it was strange to me that you were able to so quickly give me a shot that showed me a dragon that I'm used to in this world and make me understand that it has been out on its own for a while. It was so perfect. I looked at that and I went, yep, that's a dragon that's been living in the wild.
This is where it becomes so mixed in Rhaena's plotline of where I'm okay with, Rhaena and Nettles coming the same character, at least when it comes to this. I'm okay with that. I think that could be interesting. I'm okay with the resolution. It's not done, but the resolution we get this season of her meeting Sheepstealer, because I'm 100% there with you. Sheepstealer's image tells a story, and it's an effective one that we already know. It's just the bee in the middle that was just so weak of her just wandering off from the group and no one asks any questions or following her. And she's just alone in the wilderness for all that long with no food and no water and no ability to care for herself and then drinking out of little dirty rivers that are there next to her. And it's like, I get you wanted to make the A to C connect in some way, but couldn't you have thought of some better way to do it? Because that's a really eye-rolling, hand-waving kind of bee that you're just going to hope I forget with how exciting C is going to be now and in the future.
One small thing I'd have done differently in that sequence is when Rhaena approaches the creek, I would not have had her drink as if she was starving or dying of thirst.
Yes,
I think that was a bad move because it indicates to me that she was in a desperate state to get water. And if she was truly in a desperate state to get water, she would have spent a little bit more time at that creek getting additional, figuring out a way to transport it, or she would have stayed right there. That was nonsensical to me.
So much for just wandering off is that there's so much you could have done more intelligent and capable character, and you were undermining that by having her just seemingly do this on a whim with no plan, no foresight, and almost certain to die to even attempt this.
Okay.
Why do that?
So the content creators for Game of Thrones who cover this show successfully, who are all telling us that we're wrong, that the show, that this was a really good episode of television, they got an answer for you about this, Spencer. They got an answer.
Tell me.
That it was obvious that Jane Arryn, who you think is boring, allowed Rhaena to walk off. That Jane Arryn was in on this with Rhaena. That when she turned her back too quickly. She should have watched them a little bit longer. But she was in on it with Rhaena and also had informed her guards to allow Rhaena to walk off. Why? Because it's in her best interest that Rhaena claim Sheepstealer to get Sheepstealer out of the Vale. So it's obvious that they were all in this together.
No,
you're
it
just
ain't.
Not getting it.
No, it ain't. You gave me nothing to get that other than having her present that to Rhaena. There was no conversation between the two of them. There was nothing depicted on screen other than the idea that she had inserted that thought in Rhaena's head. And even then, that does nothing to actually bolster Rhaena as a character. She didn't have a hidden backpack that had supplies in it. She didn't have a plan that she worked out anything else. She just runs off in her dress clothes. Give me something more than that to show this character isn't just having a moment psychotic break of desperation to go find a dragon and wanders off accordingly. You want to say that Jane had a plan here? Fine. I'm willing to headcanon some of that. I'm willing to headcanon at least that she puts the thought in Rhaena's head. But you can't say it's a plan between the two of them if you don't give me some degree of foresight going into Rhaena's decision, which we get none of that.
I was sarcastic in mentioning that because I think that this is where some of the people who engage in the thing that we're doing here, which is follow a show closely, talk about it, attempt to be entertaining in the process, hopefully enlighten people who are following the show on a couple things that we caught that maybe you didn't catch, run into trouble, which is where they start to create theories and craft ideas because of how closely they watch it. And that's fun to do, right? We do a lot of that here.
Sure, yeah.
See my theories about why Aemon was not to be blamed for anything in the first four episodes. It's fun, but it's a reach. All of it's a reach, right? But then taking that theory and weaponizing it against fans who don't have the same reaction to the show that you do. Like, the idea that Jane Arryn is in on what Rhaena is doing, you absolutely know it. It's devoid of real proof in the show. You could cook up a theory about it, and it's a fun theory, but we certainly don't have anything on screen that tells the case. And then you want to throw that back at somebody who doesn't like the plot line and say, well, you're just not getting it. It's not a great look from a content creator who's following this show. And it's, I wish people wouldn't do so much of that. If people didn't like the episode, they didn't like the episode. I would argue that there's enough people who didn't like this episode that there's merits to the complaint. When the outrage for an episode is this loud and this uniform and what they didn't like, that maybe instead of getting online and telling everybody they're wrong, the answer is to take those to heart. And talk about them in a way that's honest for the fan base who took the show in and had that reaction.
This isn't a Rhaenyra kissing Missaria kind of moment of where the outrage seems to be driven by things that are outside the episode kind of thing in terms of responding to it. There's complaints. There's reasonable grounds in my mind for criticism they could offer here, and they can come from a very positive place of discussing where is the story going, how is it going there, and what steps can be did to address some of these issues in the future. That can be a very civil discussion, but it can't be a discussion if you're just immediately dismissing everybody that's raising these complaints as being ignorant, stupid, or naive.
Yeah. So there you go. That's my thoughts on that. It's my thoughts on the fan reaction and also the sort of backlash to the fan reaction. Any other thoughts about the episode or the season, Spencer?
One thing I want to discuss is those relationships that I mentioned earlier, because I feel like this is a moment to discuss given how much the show is building up Alicent. And like you and I have discussed, I'm much more positive in how they did Rhaenyra Alicent's relationship in season one than how it's gone here in season two, of where season two just feels like because they want to make them everything and their relationship the focal point, it's almost hamstrung or chained both their characters in terms of being able to progress. Where Alicent's able to in some way because she's away from Rhaenyra, but then she comes right back to her at the end and feels like it's diluting a lot of that. Relationships I did like. I thought Rhaenyra and Daemon's been well handled. I like how they came back together. I like the moment with respect to him. I think it may be, I thought Damon's plotline went on a little too long, and I had some issues with getting in the prophecy, but I feel like the tensions they had were real, and what's brought them back together feels earned. I'm curious to see where they go in the future, because I think their relationship feels more of the hurt for the characters than anything with respect to Rhaenyra and Allison in my mind. Another relationship I thought worked pretty well is Rhaenyra and Jace, mm-hmm. to the point that I wish they'd done more. I feel like the scenes of tension between the two of them and support between the two of them were very good over the course of this episode. I was a little disappointed that they seem like they've gotten estranged, and so I hope that the conversation with Bale brings them back together, because that it offers a lot of great perspective into Jace and through him, Allison, through the idea of what tensions Jace has with her plans because of his perspective on himself. And the fact that Rhaenyra, almost similar to Corlys, really similar to Corlys now that I think about it, the fact that she's unwilling to have that conversation shows a lot about her in a way that's not good about her character. And I like that that's an aspect of her flaw, that she's in some ways unwilling to be honest with her son about his parentage, and that's hurting him. And it shows a weakness to her that she shared in some ways with Corlys, and I like that they went into that with respect to that.
Oh, that's a good point. They both kind of did the same thing.
Yeah.
Or similar things with one of their children. That's a great parallel I hadn't thought of.
I like that. I like that a lot. I wish we get more of a conversation than we got previously. We got an aspect of the Allen of Hull confrontation that Jace offered to Rhaenyra, but it didn't seem like Rhaenyra accepted it fully, and it was brushed aside and put off elsewhere. And if anything, Bale is almost criticizing Jace for caring about it, which is a weird read in some ways. It's like, no, he actually has some reasonable things he wants to express here, and they two of them need to talk. He does need to buck up and actually, you know, come out of his funk. Sure, 100% there with you. But a lot of this is on Rhaenyra, that she's just never been willing to be fully honest with her son and heir. And that needs to actually be discussed more, and I hope they will. You mentioned Rhaenyra and Missandei. Love it. Love their relationship. Only flaw I see in it, in terms of how the show's presented it in my mind, is that I like, in some ways, that it's gone a little bit romantic. I think that's something that could be interesting to explore, and a fun tension and a fun edge to the, both her relationship, but also Rhaenyra's relationship with other people. I'm kind of there with it. But
yeah, sure.
Its problem is that it was ad-libbed. Its problem is that it was actor-suggested. And so after it happened, it's never been referenced again. And that's a problem. I hope they go back into season two, because we talked about that they had problems with rewrites, the writer's strike, they couldn't incorporate that kind of thing in there. But I don't like that it wasn't referenced ever again between the characters. We could assume some degree of simmering tension, but you don't have to. You don't have to assume it's simmering tension. It's just tension between characters of different philosophies. They're trying to work together. The fact that it was never any aspect of explicit romantic or hinted again is a flaw that seems set up by the fact they couldn't do rewrites. That actors suggested a good thing, they worked it in, but then they couldn't incorporate into what else they did. So I hope we get more into that in season two. I suspect we will. But I would mark it in my mind as a minor flaw that we didn't get any more of that in the rest of season three, and the rest of it in season two. How do you feel about that? Do you think we got some degree of hint between the romantic tension between the two of them afterwards, or was that left out to a certain degree by writing issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people do this, right? I think this happens in life where people who are friends have a hookup and then choose for whatever reason to delay a conversation about it. It might be more pressing matters. It might be uncomfortable. It might be need to figure out some things with other romantic partners. This happens. So the idea that they had a romantic interaction and then didn't talk about it again the next few interactions is not crazy to me. It's not something that is out of mind.
Sure,
what would be is if it was never mentioned again. And so I think that you're absolutely right that they need to somehow address it in season three. I think they will. I'm okay with it. I mean, sometimes they peel the curtain back too much, right? Like maybe it was not good for us to know that the actors ad-libbed it, because now we think it's like almost like non-canon in some way. They kept it in, so it's part of the show, and I'm sure that they will do what they need to do to make the narrative make sense around it. But At this point, I'm not out on it. And I have come to like that it happened because, for the reasons I said on the episode where we recapped it, where I felt like it made sense that both of them would find solace in a particularly away from men for that period. And I also, think it makes sense that Rhaenyra was craving something because she was a little alone. I mean, hell, the entire premise of this segment that you've got here, which is a great segment, by the way, is that Rhaenyra has very limited relationships. She doesn't have a lot of people she's close with. So she found someone and she was craving that. Make sense?
Yeah, I think it's summarized in some ways with the last relationship I assigned them is the relationship she has with Rhaenys and Corlys, of where these are her closest advisors. They're the closest in some ways to elder family members that she has. But they don't really have much of an actual relationship from what we actually see. With Rhaenys, you called her out as being just the wizened. I don't want to assign the term wizened to a female actress. That's a bad word to assign. She's also not that old. But the elder figure, the advisor, the Obi-Wan, as it were. You know what I'm trying to avoid here.
The Obi-Wan. That works. We're full of Star Wars references this episode.
Yeah, it works. But it's meant to be the mentor of where she was always offering good wisdom. She was always offering good guidance. She was always right. Yes or no, we could debate that to a certain degree. But it felt like a lot of what was the tension in their relationship in season one about you totally had my son killed, you totally have usurped my house, I'm really not okay with it, I'm going to go along with you because I think you're the best option, and I'm going to almost force you to now marry my grandchildren to your grandchildren so I can establish this link going forward, but still fuck you. That was interesting in season one. Season two, they don't go into any of that. Rhaenys is just 100% Rhaenyra's camp, and we don't get any degree of the tension with respect to that. Corlys, too. We don't get any confrontation. But the main feeling he has about Rhaenyra is she's basically, taken over my house without my control, got my son and heir killed, and now married Daemon, and now is just dictating what I do with my life, and I'm not okay with that. We get some measure of resistance, a little bit of that, but it's not explicit in terms of his conversations with Rhaenys. But they never really offers it to Rhaenyra other than a little bit here at the end that I liked of when he goes into the idea about, I'm following you because my wife, not really because of you. And I kind of want to tell you that to your face right now. I just wish we got more of that over the course of the season because I feel like despite the fact these two are meant to be her main advisors and main guidance, they're just offering advice. They're not actually having much of a relationship. And I missed that from season one of where we had that tension, we had those edges that season two hasn't seemed to be as interested in exploring. How have you felt about the relationship she's had with these two figures of representing House Valyrian, her most important and powerful of allies in many ways?
The most interesting relationship from the book, from Fire and Blood, when the section of it that deals with Dance of the Dragons for me is Rhaenyra and Corlys.
Yeah.
And they're not exploring that a quarter as much as I would have wanted them to. We got one conversation with them today, and it's felt very surface level. I would like way more between Rhaenyra and Corlys. I kind of bought, but I grant you that I had to make headcanon to do it. So I'll grant you that I'm filling in the blanks a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of bought that Rhaenys's view of Rhaenyra flipped on its head once she became the actual monarch. That her view of how women are treated in society, that she almost felt sorry for Rhaenyra, that she was thrust into this position, that there was a pity of, oh gosh, she's not ready for this. She's got half or more of the kingdom against her. She's not, she hasn't been trained for it properly because she's a woman. She's going to meet all this resistance in trying to do this job because she's a woman. That a lot of those lingering frustrations and resentments fell by the wayside because of the pity she had for the position that she was in. Now that doesn't make much, that sounds good, what I just said, right? In a clip. Mm-hmm. But the lingering resentment was, you killed my son, which is not like a, stiff me on the bill, a couple times we ate out dinner or something. Like it's a big deal. But in my mind, it made sense that her view of Rhaenyra would change once she assumed the crown.
I can buy that, but I don't buy there isn't tension. I can buy her accepting that, But I still would have loved to have some degree of conversation, either with Rhaenyra or otherwise, to acknowledge that that's still there. I almost feel like the show wants to make us forget it, just because they've never talked about it again. In a way, I can't find realistic. Even if years have passed, they fundamentally believe she murdered their kid.
So that's
gotta be an aspect
of
their relationship.
So the only way it works is if they didn't really fundamentally believe that Rhaenys was pushing that out of grief, but that she didn't truly believe it, right? That's the only way this works.
Maybe, but all they ever showed us in the show was they believed it. If they don't believe it, you need to give us something to suggest that, other than...
All right, I'll do it. All right, Spencer, I'll join the writer's room for season 3. All right, volunteer's tribute.
Thank you.
All right.
It's been a long time coming. We've been sending letters for years now.
All right. I finally agree.
Shall we go into some best quotes, sir? Because I do have a lot for this.
Best line of the episode, fire away.
You read a lot of them out, so I necessarily won't repeat them here, but Larry's talking to Aegon is a lot of great lines. It's a lot of great material. I'll do a few. It's best to live, I think, however you do it. You are not alone. Do not despair your grace. There are better days ahead. Let your brother and the pretender destroy themselves in blood and bitterness. When they are spent, their armies in tatters, we will return, and the people will rise up to meet us. And then after that, a little bit, they will be tired of endless deprivation and fear. They will hail the returning king, his father's true heir, Aegon the Victorious, risen from the ashes, Aegon the Peacemaker, Aegon the Rebuilder, Aegon the 35 other things that Lee inserted in there that were great, that he should have gone through all of them, but ending with Aegon the Realm's Delight, coming from Aegon himself. Great scene, powerful scene, love the relationship between the characters, love how they're depicted on screen. Another one, we referenced it. But I love the scene between Corlys and Rhaenyra, including the closing line from Chorus of, "We'll rejoin the blockade on the morrow. Let our forces beware, be they Lannister or Greyjoy, but my ship is no longer the Sea Stink. She was a testament to my own glory. I've given her a new name, the Queen Who Never Was. I thank you. What I do now, I do for her. Your grace, we are ready. You have 6 dragons under your banner. My ships sail at your command. My men serve you. But the Lannisters are marching, the high towers from Old Town. You must crush this beast at its head before too many days have flown." And then, anyway, there is, of course, another player that has yet been revealed. I like that the two of them finally talked. You talked about it. Like, give me 4 times what you're giving me of Corlys and Rhaenyra. Please! The actors work well off each other. They're great in scenes together. Please go into more of their relationship and him being an active advisor, because you are leaving material to rot in the sun and the rain by not doing so. You cited it word for word, so I won't recite it, but Aemond talking with Alicent, with fighting over the future of Helena, is just great. And I love the philosophical tension that our play from the character growth that Alicent has had over the course of the season, and us getting to see much more of the beast that Aemond truly is. I recited it basically word for word, so I won't do it again. But Cole Gwane, great stuff. Love the philosophical tensions we're seeing between the two of them. Love to see the journey that Cole has been on. And two of the characters work great, and Gwane has been so wonderfully realized here on the show. Let's see here. This is happening. Oh, the scene of Bela and Jace. They're an insult to us, to what makes us Targaryens. If any common lout can ride a dragon, then that does not make me common. Or you. You know what I am. Him responded, "You know what I am." Her responded, "I don't care. You're the crown prince, the son of the rightful queen, and here you are sulking because you believe that if not for the dragon or the trappings of your station, that you are nothing. Do you believe that you are the first noble heir who was not sired by his noble father? Such is the way of the world, Jason, and in resenting it, you only diminish yourself." He responds, "Easy enough to say. I've heard whispers the whole of my life, Bela. Then prove to them that you are worthy. Get up and take your place by your mother's side." I have a bit of an issue that so many conversations, of course, the show are women basically telling men to either man up or, acknowledge women as being in positions of power. It's a repeated theme that we see a lot, but it is important here that this is a conversation between individuals who are actually able to talk to each other. And it's a meaningful advice that she's offering about not just pitting yourself, but taking active steps to earn the world you want to be.
Yeah, I think having characters where there are strong women, and there are strong women who are pushing men toward what they should do or toward greatness, like is great. That's an interesting thing in literature and storytelling. when that's all there is, it gets a little rough. Like I think we need the show, in my opinion, is in need of like one capable man. And maybe that's what Alan of Hull is. Maybe Alan is like one capable guy, but they don't seem to have a lot of actual capable males in the show.
Mm-hmm. Or at least they're more willing to go into the flaws of the male characters more than they are into the female. And I think that's part to a certain degree of the whitewashing or trying to make likable as long as possible of Rhaenyra and Allison. But we've talked about that to no end. From back and forth between Rhaenyra and Ulf, a knight will comport himself with grace at the queen's table. Best make me a knight then. Just like that. From Alice Rivers, but also with Helena jumping in here at the end. When you came here, you were a closed fist. You wished to bend the world to your will, but you've discovered, I think, that the world will not be governed. There are omens here for those who seek them. You do not scoff? I'm no longer inclined to. I'm pleased to hear it. Do you wish, then, to learn what is given to you? All your life, you have sought to command your own fate. But today, you're ready. And with Helena jumping in after the vision, it's all a story. You are but one part in it. You know your part. You know what you must do. And then Helena talking with Aemon shortly thereafter. And if I refuse, will you burn me as you did Aegon? That is a lie. I saw it. You burned him and you let him fall. What you say is treason. Aegon will be king again. He's yet to see victory. He sits on a wooden throne. And you? You'll be dead. You were swallowed up in the god's eye and you were never seen again. I could have you killed. It wouldn't change anything. God, I love that. I love what you and I kind of unpacked and discovered for ourselves in terms of the perspectives that Helena has versus Alice when it comes to the future and prophecy. From Daemon, the realm's only hope is a leader who can reunite it. My brother chose you. You are the true queen, Rhaenyra, first of her name, protector of the realm. I am meant to serve you and all of these with me until death or the end of our story. I like that you just even turn a phrase to the end of our story, and it fits into some of the visions that they've now had. I'm going to recite a little bit of that I liked from Rhaenyra and Alison, because I think it deserves some mention as at least being well-written.
Sure, I agree.
You want to help me. Is this the help you offer after all these years? A reminder to be grateful? I mean, no offense. You may go. Do you know what it was like? I'm saying this. This is the scene between Alan and Corlys. I'll get to the scene later. You already recited this almost word for word. So just repeat it. My second favorite scene of the episode. It's utterly great. Let's see here. You already did the scene with Masari and Rhaenyra. That was really well. That was a good series of lines. And I like that we got that. Here is what I saved from Alice and Tamira. Ooh, the incorruptible queen sullies herself with a lover. Do not judge me for what you've done. What you yourself have done. Your father died, and I took comfort with another. I too have desires. Yes, but you alone made virtue your banner. And then Spodic Malice, and I clung to it in defiance of you, I think, who so disdained it. I like that. That felt like a little bit of the season one conversation happening again, of the two of them talking about why they did what they did, and it coming down to the roles that were kind of accepted to play versus Rhaenyra refusing to act with them. I like that those tensions from season one were at least gave a certain degree of voice here again. But those are the lines I have for you, sir. God Emperor of the segment, which one do you choose to pick?
As God Emperor of the segment, I will do something the show did not do, and that is acknowledge that this is a season finale. So in acknowledging that this is a season finale, I pick a line that I think is more forward-looking while also summarizing what we've seen to date. So this is from Cole to Gwaine. The dragons dance, and men are like dust under their feet, and all our fine thoughts, all our endeavors are as nothing. We march now toward our annihilation.
I love it. It's a great line, wonderfully delivered, and so thematically appropriate, I feel, for what journey those two characters have been on.
Winners, losers of the episode season?
At least at this stage, I struggle to say Rhaenyra isn't the winner of this episode. I mean, gets everything she wants and more. I mean, Daemon's back in within her camp. She's got dragons. Corlys is fully on her side and leading a fleet to war. She hears from Alicent that she could have a coup de main to completely capture King's Landing. The Starks have arrived. Her army in the Riverlands is prepared. it's a whole series of things coming up Rhaenyra. It's the question of whether she's willing to pay the necessary price to use them.
Hard to say anything other than Rhaenyra as winner of the episode and winner of the season.
Yeah. Where it was a struggle for her at times in season one and she ended on an incredibly low point, this is triumphant. She has so many different things that are coming to her banner now. She has risks that she doesn't know about. She has problems. But at least at this stage for where things presently are, I think that she is the unquestioned winner of the, but not only the episode, but the season.
Agreed. And loser of the episode?
I got Aemon. I feel like Aemon has, he's ending at a lower point than he ever has in a very long time, of where he now realizes he isn't the only show in town. He now realizes that his own family isn't loyal to him. His mother's actively conspiring to take away his capital. There's an army in the Riverlands put together against him that is much more massive than anything he's bringing to bear. He's got dragons that are nearly as big as his and far more numerous. The guy's got problems, and he seems to be aware of them and acting out accordingly. He can't even get his own sister to ride her damn dragon. It's not a great episode for Aemon.
Aemon's up there, but I wouldn't put him as number one in the episode. I mean, Aemon can still jump on Vhagar. And yes, they have seven dragons against one. But that, you know, when you are a part, this is for people who like haven't actually been in fights. Mm. If you are a part of a group that's four or five deep, and all four of y'all are smaller than the person you want to jump, but you know you can take them all, like five of you, you can take them. Y'all still have to have the nerve to jump on them.
Yeah.
Like, it still requires all five people in a coordinated effort to jump on the one person and to be willing to take an individual ass beating if that person turns to you. If all five can get on the same page and do that, yeah, you'll probably win. But that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. So, yeah, they have she's going to have to get these dragon riders to be willing to go face Aemon and potentially die and not turn tail and run as soon as Vhagar turns toward them. She's going to have to be willing to die, or Jace, or Bela, in the exchange. And don't you think that if they did that, that Aemon would absolutely target the monarchs in that group? So I'm not so sure that they have a strategy yet for killing Vhagar. So I still don't put him as number one. Number one for me is Alfred Broom, who takes a massive L this episode.
It's a big risk, and it does not pay off.
Took a shot, failed, and now has nowhere to go. So Alfred Broom, big loser for me of the episode.
Who do you think is losing but think they're winning? I struggled with this one this episode. I don't think Allison. It could be Allison, but I think she's too depressed and acknowledging how shit her situation is to think that she's really winning. But I'm with you that she's still got a plan to win in some shape or form, and that's overconfident as shit.
Yeah. But her plan sucks.
It does.
Her plan sucks, and what she thinks is about to happen is not going to happen.
Yeah. It, in no small part because it's already failed. Aegon's left. She can't fulfill the terms of what she's offered.
Exactly. I agree with you. I think Rhaenyra is going to fly hot when she gets there and Aegon's not there.
Okay. I'll pick Allison then, just because she does not know that Aegon has already left and is out of her ability to control and manipulate the way she assumes she could.
So that's an old country phrase I use, fly hot, like when you get mad at somebody. That's actually, fly that's hot lawyer. Is actually a really good explanation for a dragon rider, isn't it? Flying hot.
Aemon was flying hot a lot of this episode.
So, I would say Allison. You're not saying Allison, though. Who are you saying?
You convinced me more, because I was thinking maybe Ulf is being all kinds of overconfident throughout this episode, but that was a struggle. I'm convinced Allison's the best pick right now, because her Hail Mary treaty to offer her some means of, you know, polite and comfortable exile is now already failed and gone.
Okay. All right. Well, and who is the villain in the show? I struggle with who the villain is at this point. I think Aemon definitely is somebody to root against. But I also think that, like, we've looked at Corlys as a heroic figure, and I think that this episode took him down a peg as a heroic figure. And I also think that Rhaenyra as the aggressor might change how we view her as a heroic figure. So I think there's a lot to consider when trying to parse through who to root for and who not to in the show.
I think Aemon's the easiest black hat, but I think the show has done a good job of increasingly putting in thoughts or concerns that some of the characters we've framed as heroes may be willing to do very dark deeds, and that needs to be acknowledged and may come to a head next season, assuming that we're going to get some degree of resolution next season, which I think we reasonably can.
Yeah, I think we'll get some resolution next season. Okay, wrap-up thoughts, Spencer. What else do you have to say about the season and episode?
I still liked the season. I think it had a lot of great episodes. What we're hearing now that HBO drove a bit of this, or HBO's new masters, in terms of cutting off the two episodes, feels real and is fundamentally disheartening. This would have been a successful episode 8 of a 10-episode season. It's not a successful finale. I think the fact that it is the finale makes some of its problems more stark. I mean, episode 8 of the old seasons of Game of Thrones, usually you and I just kind of like assumed it was going to be a weaker episode. We assumed it was going to have some problems and mostly be a setup episode, so we know what to expect in episodes 9 and 10. This has those, but because it's a finale, all we can do is just dwell on them, and that brings them more to the fore. I had some overarching problems maybe with the season for what the writers cared about more than I did. I felt like the season ultimately serves more as setup than its own effectively bit of resolution or its own package, much more so than season 1 did. But I think I ultimately still liked it more than season 1, just because its individual parts, in my mind, ultimately are better than the individual parts of season 1, even if I think that they didn't come together as well as they probably should have due to factors outside of the show's maybe control.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you said. I think anytime you have a show and the fans have knowledge of and animosity toward the network because of what the network's done to the show, you're in a bad spot. That's not a good spot for the network to be in, not a good spot for the show to be in. Also not a good spot, as I've mentioned, that the only people, not the only people, but some of the loudest people who are trying to defend the show are having to do so by just saying, you're too dumb to get it. All you want is a big dragon battle, and you're too simple to understand this highly complex story and show. Bad spot for the show to be in. I hope that we're going to throw 7 cliffhangers at you, and we hope that you can hold that in your head for 2 years. Not necessarily the best spot for the show to be in. So ultimately, I think that the show ends in a weaker spot than it was starting this season. I still enjoyed the season. I had a good time. I had a good time talking with you about it, talking to our fans about it. Thank you all for writing in and engaging and listening. But I'd hope for a little bit more.
Yeah. And hoping for more isn't necessarily a bad thing. You're still excited, as you said, for season 3. I'm still excited. It's more... The finale didn't nourish that excitement. That could have been executed much more better in terms of giving me in a position of being encouraged for what's going to come after. They taunted me with what's coming after. They certainly suggested what we're going to get for the next 2 episodes of the show. But the fact that it didn't end on its own, you know, comfortable point, its own point that felt complete, it just kind of leaves me frustrated going into the next season rather than necessarily as excited about it as I should be.
And I certainly get that. All right. Well, thank you for doing the podcast with me, Spencer. Thank you for reviewing the show, hanging out in Westeros for a little while. Thank you all for listening. Been on a good run of podcasts recently. We did Shogun, Fallout, House of the Dragon, back to back to back. We're going to take a break now. We'll be back at some point. Your podcast feed, don't unsubscribe. Please continue to check facebook.com/mangumtalks, X at mangumtalks, or www.mangumtalks.com. for updates about what we're going to be up to next. And you can always write us at mangumtalkspodcast@gmail.com if you have thoughts about anything we've covered or thoughts about what you'd like us to cover or what you'd like us to do on the podcast. We'll be taking a break, but we'll be back before too long